This is HBR episode 2555 entitled, HBR 2017 New Year's Eve Show Part 6. It is hosted by various hosts, and is about 1932 minutes long, and carries an explicit flag. The summary is, Part 6 of the 6th Annual HBR New Year Show.
This episode of HBR is brought to you by Archive.org. Support universal access to all knowledge by heading over to archive.org/donate.
What would you like to talk about?
I have a Linux topic. I'm delaying on putting up a Ubuntu server. I'm just wondering how much room the new snap-based or stuff will take up compared to the traditional Debian.debs. The server I've got is an old single-core 64-bit.
Wait a minute, the snap stuff, I'm not sure quite, but I think the snaps are generally smaller now than they used to be. I'm not sure on that one there.
Well, it's only got 2 gigs of memory, and I was wondering whether I should stay with the Debian, a straight Debian based, or get ready for 18.04.
You wouldn't put, well, they put an early 18.04 development thing on if you're going to like run an actual server, surely, but. If it's Debian or Ubuntu, I guess it doesn't really matter that much from which kind of server is it. What kind of server is it?
Well, it'll be a utility server. Just it's the first machine that I got, largely a hacking machine. It's my first 64-bit hacking machine that'll allow me to
Right,
learn.
Right. There's obviously 18.04 is not out yet in final release, so don't put a development version on. That's what I meant. But I don't really run servers myself like that. But I think generally it doesn't matter that much. So you have to just make a choice. Unless somebody else here has a comment on that one.
You said it was a 64-bit single core machine.
AMD 1250.
I guess I don't know much about the AMD processors. The 2 gigabytes is kind of lean for anything with a GUI, but if you're looking at just a server, 2 gigabytes will do pretty much any of the Linux distros that I've used.
Yeah, I was just wondering whether to go with a Debian base like the Sparky that I use currently, or go with something that's, I know that they're going to be pushing flat packs and snaps and such like that on the, on 1804.
But the thing is, with this, you know, with snaps and flat pack stuff, I mean, yeah, it's supposed to make putting packages easier, more proprietary software, for example, could just go into a snap or flat pack. But, you know, is it really needed? And it probably isn't really, but yeah, Canonical decided to do Snappy and GNOME's and flat pack and, you know, is it really needed and for what you're doing as well, you know?
Well, that's why I have some 16 gig 64 multi-cores. And I would just dual boot Ubuntu on that when I need the Ubuntu stuff. Just some stuff I need that's PPA based. And I have some trouble putting Ubuntu Debs PPAs into Debian basic Deb system.
What is it you're doing that you're having trouble with?
Well, I just find it easier to put PPAs under a full Ubuntu machine. I mean, Ubuntu system. And this was going to be a utility machine, but I may separate out the basic server function with some lightweight Linux, like any of my Sparkies, and then go with a secondary setup on one of my larger machines, just in case, so that I can use a more full configured Ubuntu.
Hi, Clacky here, celebrating New Year's morning in Hong Kong, or lunchtime at this point. Snappy packages, how do they work? I have the impression that they're more coarse-grained than normal packages, so that you might have redundancy both on disk and in RAM between two packages that have a shared dependency. Is that right?
Hello, Clacky. How come I hold you there for an hour or come I do a hug me?
Tjena. Nej, jag kommer ihåg att det var någon som hade en svensk anknytning, men inte så mycket mer än så.
Yeah, we
actually the idea goes back to the early days of Linux. The packages are basically statically linked binaries.
Yeah, so that would mean the same bytes which would normally belong to a shared library would end up several times occupying RAM.
Yeah, not very good for a small memory machine, and 2 gigs is small memory these days.
Yeah, it wouldn't make sense to load the packages that essentially bring in an entire environment. When I would go with the application directly. If you're running a Debian machine, you bring in a Debian package just for that application. And then you're not gonna have any problem with the two gigabyte memory.
Well, I do want to have the option of, you know, I would probably make it into another of my XFCE Sparky Linux, which Sparky is great, and it should perform adequately for anything I want to do.
Well, you can always try it and see if it performs to your expectations or requirements.
Yep, I think that's what I'm going to do. Also, I have room on my other machines to eventually put a regular Ubuntu. Sometimes it's nice to have the capability of booting Ubuntu on systems because, you know, you have the PPAs and whatnot.
Okay, I thought you were talking about a server at first. Are you talking about a desktop?
I'm talking about a server. However, because I'm a refugee from Windows, I would like the option of running a desktop, at least a lightweight desktop.
Okay, a refugee, huh? All right. I think that I require a desktop with a GUI all the time, and there are servers that do some things for us, but you have to have a GUI, and whether you're a refugee from Windows or not.
Well, I'm just saying that I don't trust myself with a purely command line system. Now, eventually, I probably will run my desktop over XGO or something, or VNC, or networked Wayland, or what have you, when they get that worked out. I just figure that at my level of knowledge, having the ability to run a web browser, a graphical web browser for troubleshooting or what have you on the box. It's a home system, so it's not exactly going to be loaded on anything special. And again, it's a hacking machine.
Okay, I've got a better picture of it now. Thank you.
I would load 1604, but it's going out of support, so I might as if I'm going to start with a new installation, I might start with something that's easier to keep up.
Wait, 16.04, that's gone until 2021, really.
Also, if it's a Sparky machine, it runs the same stuff that my main desktops run. The Ubuntu side is strictly a secondary function.
I'm relatively new with Linux the last couple of years, and I'm trying not to have to try to learn too many different things, and so I go to install a server to do something, and it looks like the best option is FreeBSD on something, and then Debian on something else, but I'm running Ubuntu on my desktop, and I'm looking really, really, really hard to find a way to make everything Ubuntu so I don't have to learn too much stuff.
BSD, that can be good for servers as well, but saying that, most servers are running Linux now of any sort.
Well, I was looking at a firewall that was FreeBSD.
There's a built-in Linux firewall, I believe.
Say again?
There's a built-in Linux firewall, I believe. Well, most distros seem to have some sort of firewall turned on now, built-in. But desktop distros, servers are going to be a bit different, possibly.
Well, actually, I've decided I am going to go to what's it called? Smoothwall? Is that the thing that runs on Ubuntu?
No, I don't think so, but yeah, there'll be a few options that I would have thought. Clacky, anyway, are you here?
Yeah, I have.
We're having a bit of Hong Kong.
Hong Kong is a bit colder this year than it was last year, 24 hours ago. We had several days of degrees Celsius, and today it's looking more like 15 degrees.
My fair debt told you.
Well, it's just weather. You never know what it's going to do.
It's going to be summer over there, isn't it? Isn't it?
Hong Kong has winter right now.
Oh, it's got. Oh, yeah. Oh, that's true. China's got.
We're still north of the equator.
And it gets even colder there, apparently.
It can get down to 10 Celsius here some winters, but most of the time it stays between 15 and 20.
Who was asking about Smoothwall?
Mongo.
Yeah, Mongo. Smoothwall is a distribution of its own that is made to be a firewall for an appliance device. It's kind of like PFSense, IPFire. There's some others I can't think of right off the top of my head. So that would be something you can install it on any x86 hardware, and it would pretty much just be for that purpose as being a, the intrusion detection, like a router, basically.
Actually, I know what PSNs is, and that's what I had installed. I had got an old... I called my brother and said, "You got an old computer that you can give me?" And he said, "Let me go look in my attic." And he mailed me a motherboard that had an old dual-core Intel processor. And I put PSense on it. Of course, it had FreeBSD on it. But it was too damn particular about Ethernet cards. So I messed with that. I bought a card. I put it in. It was just a pain in the butt, and I didn't, everything, I had to go and find out what the difference was between the Ubuntu commands and the Unix commands, and I just said, I got to figure a different way to do this, and ultimately, I decided I really could afford $100 to buy a new motherboard. So I went to Micro Center. I told them I need a motherboard and processor for $100, and they did it for about $110. And so I got me a new box, and that's what I'm building my firewall router on, and it's going to be, so I'm thinking Ubuntu and Smoothwall.
You're missing the point. Smoothwall is its own distribution. You install it like Ubuntu. You don't install it on top of Ubuntu.
I understand, but when you install it, it's Ubuntu, right?
Okay. I don't know what the base OS it's based on. I've used it in the past, and you never, once you install it, you never really cared because it's all GUI based. Once you get it installed, you configure everything through a web interface, so it doesn't really matter. I mean, what the base is.
I'm an old server administrator. I'm always concerned about what is underneath the application, and I need to know how to configure it and what it's doing and things like that. Also, because while the motherboard my brother gave me was an old dual core piece of crap that would barely run the router, when I went out and bought a processor and motherboard, it turned out to be an 8-core AMD processor that had plenty of room for some other stuff, so I thought, I've got to do something else with this. So I decided to add some other stuff to it, so then I really need to know what the underlying OS is.
I think, at least with Linux, that the base doesn't matter as much anymore, because it's just package management systems and things like this, be like the desktop or the server, really. But so I think, yeah, Debian or Ubuntu or whatever, I think you'd be mostly okay with any of those, really.
I agree that any of them will work, but I'm new to this, and I'm really trying to not have to learn all the different versions of Linux.
Although Ubuntu, I believe, has, well, apparently has most of the servers now. Although I suppose some people say Debian has a large amount, actually, but there you go. Oh, and then, of course, there's Red Hat and all the rest of it.
Yeah, it seems like the you've got to go with the FreeBSD to get the best router firewall, and so that's what I was going to do, and I did, and then it was really difficult to add in additional drivers for the network card you had, and so.
Oh right, yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I don't really use BSD, but I do know enough about to know that actually, because it's basically, you know, Windows, Mac, Linux, and then BSD, you could say, is the fourth one. That means that a lot of these drivers and things. I mean, a lot of stuff built into Linux kernel anyway for hardware support. Then you get the few wireless drivers and things that aren't graphics cards. And so in the case of BSD, there's a lot of hardware support lacking, really, and things like that, as far as I know anyway.
No, that's exactly what I found.
I mean, even Flash, I mean, that probably hasn't changed. I mean, you can have like a Linux compatible layer for Flash, but yeah, that's for the desktop, but, you know, things like that as well, really.
I'm trying to be, you know, smart with this and understand the server does its job. I mean, I spent many years as a server administrator. Servers have a different role, and they can run different applications, and they can even have different versions than the desktops. But I just had problems with that one, so I decided to abandon that and go with something else. And then I end up with a Debian Jesse, which is not quite Ubuntu, but more of the Ubuntu commands do work.
That's because Ubuntu is based
on Debian.
From Debian. And I would rethink Smoothwall because it hasn't been updated since June of 2013. I would look at pfSense or something else.
You got anything else that runs on Ubuntu?
It doesn't matter on this firewall device. That's what I'm trying to get at you. You're way overcomplicating this. You could actually build your own firewall from Ubuntu, but would you trust yourself to do something that some experts who've already custom tailored a distro to be a firewall?
Actually, I like PSSense a lot. Once you installed it, the web interface was really, really good. It has absolutely everything you need. No problem configuring it. I just didn't have any problem with it at all, except that I wanted to use the box for some other stuff as well, and that's where I ran into the problems.
I would highly not recommend using your firewall as a server. Because that's like a direct, you've got that right at the edge of your network and you're using it. You want to use that as a server also?
Well, actually, I'll take it back. I forgot. The problem I had with it was the network cards. The built-in network card, I went out and bought some network cards. I ended up with trying several network cards and found what was supposed to be a driver that would work with FreeBSD, and trying to add it in was using everything I could find on the internet for how do you add a driver for an Ethernet card, and I never did get one of them working.
I'm sure if you would look, Google. I'm sure you can Google for a hardware compatibility list for PFSense. I've ran PFSense. I have a little mini ITX box. It's got an Atom processor with 2 gig of RAM, and it's got dual Realtek NICs on it, and PFSense has worked on it. Smoothwall. Right now I'm running a distro called IP Fire. There's another one that's eluding my mind, but it's Debian-based. Untangle is another one that is Debian-based at the core. But these ones I'm mentioning are, like I say, they're pre-set up to be a firewall, and you really don't even have to get to the command line to do anything with them if you don't want to. It's all install, and once you boot it up, you get to the web GUI of it.
I think I've heard of PFSense as well. I don't really do servers like this, but I guess try and use what's, especially if you're new to this, I guess try and use what's kind of popular. So Ubuntu Server or possibly Debian, although Debian might be a bit more, I would have thought, a little bit more complicated in certain ways, possibly, because it's more because of how Debian's like. But Ubuntu is based on Debian, so there's a lot of similarities as well. And,
I agree that there's PSSense I found to be a really excellent firewall, had everything I wanted in the web interface. Everything I needed, and much more. I was trying to put it on old hardware, and I wasn't going to go out and look for a hardware list and go purchase a piece of hardware that would work on it. I was trying to make it work on some old hardware, and then I got a network card, and it's Realtek, and there's a driver for it that was supposed to work on FreeBSD, and here's how you install it. And I never got it to work. And now I'm not, I'm pretty new to Linux, but I've spent the last, spent 25 years or so working as a server administrator. Actually, I guess if you add in my VAX VMS days, I'm closer to 30 years. I can figure out computer stuff. I never got that network card working, and I'm trying to get 3 network cards working so I can have a DMZ, an external and an internal card. So, so that's what I'm trying to get working. And I wasn't able to do it on the old piece of hardware. So when I got a new piece of hardware, I thought, let me get something else. I'm done with this. I really haven't tried running the PF Sense on the new hardware. Who knows? It might actually work.
It says right on the PF Sense website that your best bet is to use Intel-based NICs for the best compatibility and performance.
I know that.
One of the things about the newer or the next generation PF Sense is it's going to require hardware encryption instructions unless they've changed their mind.
The instructions are going to be encrypted?
No, Intel has a... If you go above the Atom processor or to latest processors, they have instructions that aid encryption just like they do for floating point or what have you. They are not using they are not using software to do the encryption. They're using software with special instructions to harden the encryption. I may have to go to OpenWall, which is a new fork of PFSense, because the PFSense people are going to drop compatibility for ordinary processors or processors that do not have the encryption instructions in them.
Yeah, I haven't seen that.
Well, PFSense was purchased by a commercial entity, and the commercial entity has decided to make things easier for themselves and the hardware that they sell by eliminating the ability for people to install PFSense on older generations of hardware that doesn't have the Intel's encryption instructions.
IP Fire is a very nice firewall distro too. I've never heard anything from them about this encryption thing.
Well, again, it was purchased by a business, and they're trying to lower their support costs, and they're getting less community based, more just like a lot of the Ubuntu stuff. They're slimming things down to so that it supports their business and does not support so much of the community.
I believe I even tried the OpenSense distribution when it first came out, and I didn't quite care for it because it wasn't as fine tuned as yet. So I might give that a go again sometime.
Also, again, we're talking about all of these applications. Unless you want to virtualize your firewall, which is not recommended practice, are designed for a little box, well, for some versions of little, that just does the firewall, does higher level routing and stuff, but it is what it is. It is a black box that you could have in a closet somewhere with no screen, no keyboard, and you just talk to it through a magic, web address.
Can you hear me now?
Sound good.
Okay, well, I switched headsets and workstation, so I guess this finally works.
Did you do any work on your lips?
What do you mean?
Actually, I thought some of that might have just been a problem with flappy lips or something.
Not to my knowledge.
Okay, probably wasn't that at all. It's just probably hardware. On that firewall thing, talking about not using your firewall as a server, what I was considering was using the primary function of the server as the router firewall, and also running a VM and letting the VM be a NAS. I couldn't find anything on the internet that said I couldn't completely separate that and make that safe. So that was kind of where I was headed.
Well, I'm not no paid professional or certified in any type of networking, but it's just my belief that a firewall router is an appliance treat it like an appliance. It's as a single purpose device. That's what I would recommend. I wouldn't want to attach anything sensitive directly to it and make it do anything else that could, you know, accidentally get exposed to the internet.
When I was a professional and someone else was buying the hardware and software, I would agree with you. But right now, I'm trying to be cheap, and it's for home, and I'm not protecting, you know, lots and lots of really important stuff.
Well, you'll find that there's more support for virtualizing the router than there is for virtualizing the NAS on top of the router.
I would agree there because, like I say, these firewall distributions are not, that's not what they're meant to do. To be, they don't have the hypervisors built into them, which I'm sure if you knew what you were doing and you can get to the command line of it, you could probably install one if you'd like. But when you, that's just not what they're meant to do. They're just meant to be a single purpose device.
And in the case of pfSense, I know that it has a BirdIO network card support. BirdIO is a higher level connection. Instead of fully emulating hardware, it hands the bytes off to the underlying operating system's networking stack.
I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand that.
There is an IO standard where instead of emulating an Intel 1000 card or what have you at the bit banging level, it just hands the bytes off to the to a virtual driver built into your supporting system. If you virtualize the if you virtualize the router, it you'll have, you know, vert 1, vert 2, vert 3 NICs, and those NICs will be connected by your operating system to physical NICs. And the operating system has the drivers for the NICs, and you don't have to worry about the virtual system having to fake the NICs at a bit banging level.
Okay, I think I understand that. It was my intention that the NIC would be, any NIC would be dedicated to its specific function, and there was, that way there wouldn't be any problem with any crossing between any way to for something on the outside loop to basically get it on the inside network.
I mean, if you really wanted to learn the ins and outs of a Linux firewall, you could actually install Debian, CentOS, Ubuntu, whatever, and build one yourself if you really wanted to get, you know, get down to the nuts and bolts of it.
Well, I've actually built more than one. I'm an old Windows server administrator. I've built hundreds of servers, and I've worked with the network administrators for troubleshooting problems and stuff like that. So I know how networks work with the servers, but I'm not a network expert. So I've never done the actual work, the day-to-day work of the routers. And that's the part that, while I'm not totally ignorant of it, I'm not anywhere near an expert.
Oh, I agree. And that's why I rely on other people to build a distro for me.
Oh, as far as building a distro, yeah, I'm not even thinking about that.
No, I mean, I wouldn't attempt to install a base Linux install and then create my own firewall, which can be done if you want. Like I say, if you want to get down and learn about it, you could actually create your own whatever distro X you're comfortable with and actually build your own pfSense box from Linux if you wanted to.
Well, I built a pfSense box and also a smoothwall box, and both of them are fine as far as they go. The pfSense is excellent. The Smoothwall seems to have everything too. I've not played with it as much. I've actually not a lot at all, but I've got that installed right now on a box, and I've messed with it a little bit, and it seems to have everything I'm going to need. I did notice that it had not been updated in a while, but I don't know that it's been abandoned.
No, I know they offer a purchased solution for, you know, versus the free version. I'm looking on their Smoothwall's website here right now, and I know that was, I'm a network admin at a K-12 school system, and we were looking at different solutions for web filtering, and they do offer, Smoothwall offers, you know, enterprise class solutions for business or education. I just don't know if their home version, they used to call it Smoothwall Express, which is what I've seen that looked like 2013 was the last time a release was released for it.
It's been about a month since I installed it, and I really haven't looked at it in a couple of weeks. It's been with the holidays and all that's going on. I haven't messed with it.
Was it the Express version?
I don't actually know. Well, it was free.
So I imagine that's what you got, and that was probably the same version I ran back years ago. That, like I said, looking on that website, it, the last time something was added to it was 2013.
I mean, it's still, it looks complete as far as having what you need to do the job. I may end up going, I haven't tried installing pfSense to my new server that I bought, and I may be pleasantly surprised and find out it works really well on that, and I'll just forget about messing with something else. But it was one thing about Windows, you know, us, now that I'm one of the Linux people, I can say that. Over 25 years, I've learned every version of Windows Server and desktop. They come out with a new version. Well, it's just one version. There's not 50 different distros. It's just one. And you learn it. I mean, they move stuff around. Each new release, they hide a few of the configuration things so that you have to go look for them. But basically, it's still Windows, and you learn the new version, and you don't have any option but to do that. And so I would learn the new version, and you continue, and we upgrade our systems, and we keep going. And I did that for many years. And with Linux, there's so many different versions and so many different ways to do it. And I really was trying to stick to one. I was trying to, and since I'm using Ubuntu on my desktop and I'm trying to get better with some of the command line things, I really didn't want to, when I got the, I loaded pfSense, and that stuff is really different. It's not a lot different, but it's enough different that the Ubuntu stuff doesn't work.
Right, because that's BSD-based, yeah.
Also, it sounds like, as somebody who has set up pfSense, you may have been doing stuff at the command line that they want you to do with the web interface and through the administration console.
No, all the firewall stuff I was doing at the web thing. What I was doing was the only thing I was trying to do at the command line was to get some additional network cards working. I had a box that I wanted to have three network cards, network interfaces on, and I had one. And that made it so by when you add one and it doesn't recognize it, any additional drivers have to be loaded on a command line, and that was where I had to go digging. And I found what of a website that purported to be doing that, and I found everything I needed except it didn't work.
Well, yes, because you were doing stuff for FreeBSD, which would be a server-based system. Did you try enabling optional network cards? In the GUI, there is a way to enable optional network cards, and unless you enable the optional network cards, the system won't see them.
You mean besides adding it at the there wasn't a driver for the particular card I had, I had a 505 card, but they had a driver for a 504, and the 504 worked fine, but the 505 didn't. And so I found the driver and I'm installing it, and it says it installed, but for some reason it didn't work. You say that maybe there's a place where I go in the web and tell it to now recognize that?
Well, first, you should, because there are a couple of problems. One, the best way to run the kind of thing that you're talking about is to get one of the, or even perhaps your work has retired, some Intel network, multi-port network cards that you can plug in and PFSense will recognize every port.
I realize that that may well be what I will end up doing, and if I do, I will get a multi-port card so that just one card will do it. I really was trying to do with what I had, and I attempted to find an Intel card locally and wasn't able to find it, so I went with what I had.
Did you see that link I posted in the chat for the PFSense compatibility list?
Oh, I didn't go look for that, no. I understand that there is such a list, and I know that I wasn't using it.
So you should be able, from the command line, or from, I don't know, I'm sure there's a GUI way to do this too, but you should be able to use some commands to find out what your current NICs hardware are. So, and then you should be able to look for them in that list to see if they are compatible with whatever distribution you're wanting to use.
No, I knew for a fact that the ones I had were not, they weren't on the list, or they would have been seen when I installed it. It would have said, look at these cards. Instead, it saw one instead of three. And when I went and looked, I did find the driver that said this works with FreeBSD. And I did what it said you could do to install the drivers. But after doing that, PSN still didn't recognize it. So, or rather, FreeBSD still didn't recognize when I rebooted the system. The system didn't recognize it, even, the OS.
You're not running FreeBSD.
What do you mean I'm not running FreeBSD?
You're not running FreeBSD as a server or desktop. You're running something that uses the FreeBSD kernel with customized elements that are not designed to be plugged into as a normal FreeBSD. It is a pre-cooked router distribution with all the drivers that it wants to know about built in.
You're saying I don't have the full FreeBSD server, so it doesn't have the ability for me to add additional driver things.
New generations will come out with new drivers, but this is not like you were building a FreeBSD server and dropping the same cards into it and then had to load a driver from somewhere. What you have to do is it's more like a basic Windows install where you get a Windows compatible device, whatever it is, a network card, video card, whatever, and it drops in there and it will announce to you, yay, I've seen, a LAN card of this kind, Intel, Broadcom. You may be running into Broadcom problems, or you may be running into Realtek problems or whatever, but you need to get a pretty mainstream vanilla black box, and that's why they want to go Intel, because Intel is sort of the standard. It's like a small block Chevy. You know, everybody's got parts for it. Everybody knows how to fix it.
The box was an Intel Core 2 Duo something or other. So that was normal, straightforward. The add-on cards that I was trying to put in it were Realtek. I hadn't thought about the OS being stripped down, but of course I actually knew about that. I knew that when they build security systems, with Linux, they strip out the parts, everything that's not needed to make it safer. Huh.
Also, if you want to use the power of your new 8-core machine, what you need to think about is finding cards that will drop into your old hardware and using the new machine with its new power for the full-powered Ubuntu with larger memory, larger disk, better video than your dual-core machine. Everything like that. If you have Intel NICs, a lot of the processing is handled by the network or can be offloaded onto the network card themselves. That's how come you have all those lectors in the web interface. The reason that Realtek NICs are cheap is that they require your main processor to do a lot of the things that Intel NICs do in their own internal microcode and their internal microprocessors and their own memory buffers and everything like that. Realtek NICs are very stripped down. They're very, and because they are.
Are you trying to say junk?
Close to it.
I wouldn't go
that far. No, I'm going to say Happy New Year to Central Time US.
Oh my goodness, that's me.
Well, I mean, as far as not necessarily junk, but this is like Intel stuff is like a one-ton truck, and the other stuff is like a mini pickup or minivan.
Yeah, we can stop here and say Happy New Year. The fireworks are starting to pop around my neighborhood.
Well, in regards to there being too many choices and for the GNU Linux servers and stuff, they all use the same underlying tools virtually. I'm pretty sure they're all using IP tables on the underlying, and there's different front ends for it. I think Debian's got a UFW, it's called, some firewall something. Klaatu spoke of firewall D on CentOS. But if you want to get into the command line of the underlying firewall, IP tables rules are what you're looking for.
I've been using that stuff for 40 years, and you know what? I didn't want to learn anything new.
I learned IP tables 15 years ago, and I haven't learned anything else since.
I really have been trying to be lazy on this and trying to make the box do multiple things. It's more not if I had a absolute requirement. If I was working for someone else and they were paying the freight and I was telling them what to buy, like I used to do when I was working, I'm retired. I would say you need this and this and this, and we're going to use this as your router and this is your server and this runs such and such. And I would separate those things out, and things that would work well with virtuals, I would build a virtual server and I'd run things in virtual, and other things would be separate. But now that I'm at home and it's not that big a deal, I've got I'm currently using my routers are just the off-the-shelf routers that everybody buys, and I'm going to replace that with a real machine. And the PS Sense was, wow, that's the way to go. And so I found out that I start thinking about it, I'm looking at what else can I make this thing do? And that's where I got into trouble.
As another person on a limited income, what you may need to do is think about going to Newegg or Fry's or whatever your favorite discount supplier is, maybe an online supplier, and figuring out how many slots you have free in your older desktop, older machine, and just stuff whatever you can afford, maybe dual port cards, whatever, or multi-port. The whole idea is put the router in the old box or in a refurbished whatever, and use your new box for that big multiple server, multiple learning, multiple whatever experience.
Well, actually, since I figured out that I was tired of messing with the dual core thing my brother gave me, and went out and bought the 8-core AMD motherboard and processor. That's my new box, so it's not stripped down or anything. It's, yeah, I actually bought a case for it. It has a new pre-Christmas sales, I got a really nice power supply for $19. And I had I had 8 gigs of memory left over from the last upgrade I did on my desktop system. So it's got 8 gigs of RAM, so it's not suffering there at all. So I actually have a really nice box for my whatever I wanted to do with it. And that's why I started thinking, wait a minute, this is not just a router. This can do more.
Yeah, a firewall device does not need near that much horsepower. You're way overbought for that.
Well, I went to Micro Center and I said, I need a motherboard and processor that will work with DDR3 memory, because that's what I had. And I know that pretty much everything you buy now is DDR4. And he had an old motherboard. He had like one open box motherboard that would still work. And only one version of the only processor he had. He had stacks of them, but he only had one type, and it was an 8-core AMD processor, and that would work on that motherboard. So that's what I ended up buying, and the whole thing was just barely over $100. So that wasn't a bad deal to get a pretty decent box for $100, considering I had the memory to put in it. So now I've got. So as soon as I got that, I'm thinking, wait a minute. I only wanted a dual core box because I just wanted a router, but now I've got 8 cores. I've got to think of something else to make this box do.
The general consensus is that that's a good idea. Use all that horsepower to do whatever else. Max out the RAM, whatever you want to do. But that machine, as it sits, is too much power for a dedicated router. We're talking about how to build a dedicated router that you plug in to replace your civilian, your off-the-shelf units, and use that box as your, as basically your central, I want to do anything I want to do.
What do you think about setting this box up as a VMware server and having running everything as a VM, including the router? Can you do that? My external router as a VM, as well as anything else I want to do with the box?
That is a possibility. That's what we're talking about. And you wouldn't necessarily have to go to VMware. There's something, there's a lot of VM capable stuff, which would allow you to put the pfSense in a VM inside. There's something called Proxmox, which is designed for this kind of application.
Well, I said VMware specifically because I've used VMware for many years, and I have had a VM box in at home for a long time. I don't have one right now, but I know how it's something I know how to do really well. I have tried some of the Linux running VM. I've tried a couple of the other VM things, and they don't seem as complete.
Well, that's why I recommend Proxmox. It's a system that's designed to support VMs.
Is it a bare metal hypervisor?
Correct. And it's based on Debian, so...
I'll look at that. That's one I haven't tried.
Also, they have a rather inexpensive subscription to keep your core updated.
Inexpensive? VMware is free.
Well, yes, you can get the free version, but it doesn't update. To get access to their security fixes and stuff, you have to get a subscription.
Okay, I've got the most experience, of course, with VMware because I was using that when I was working, and we had a commercial license for it. And the when I always had a version at home, but in the some years ago, VMware allowed you to have they had some limitations on it, but you could install it for free for non-commercial use, and that's what I had at home, and I think they removed most of those restrictions except for using it for commercial use, and so it's free now. So that's the reason I've used it mostly. I've other VMs I've tried, it's just to play with them and find out that they didn't really stand up to VMware, which of course has been in business for a lot longer than most of the others. Well, we've probably beaten this one to death. Anybody else got anything they're working on?
Yeah, it's been talking earlier with Parsons. PMBOX, I built six Lightning. I had a little box with a mix and external power supply. Lightning zapped it over here a couple months back, and haven't got around to it because the way it wants, it'll try to boot and quit. And a lot of people have external power supply. Finally, Motorola part number tonight on Google. And while my supply is rated 3 amps, all the ones on Google, the exact same part number, 2.5. At least domestically. I mean, you find them on eBay.
50, your audio is horrible now.
Again?
Cyloning bad. Mongo, I just pasted a link to a little mini ITX board that would be perfect for a firewall box.
I'll take a look at that.
Now, the board is $90. That doesn't include the CPU or RAM. So you're probably going to get up around $200 to $250 by the time you get it completely configured. But then you'd have to buy a case for it. But that's what you're looking for, something small and mini like that with two NICs. It's got two Intel NICs, so...
Wait a minute, I've only got $150 a month in my 8-core box.
Well, that's because you could have went and bought two $20 Intel NICs for your dual-core box and had a firewall. So you spent you could have spent $20 and had one up and running with on that dual core, and there'd been plenty of machine to run PFSense.
And if we are just being completely honest, that's probably what I'm going to end up doing anyway.
Now, how much RAM with the new system?
The new system has got 8 gigs of RAM in it. The dual core box has 4. So I could go back to the dual core system with the 4 gigs of RAM and put a nice Intel dual NIC adapter in it, and it would work just fine, I'm sure. I'd have to buy it off online. I don't buy anything online, pretty much. And what am I going to do with this this computer here? You know what I can do with an 8-core, 8-gigabyte system?
Well, if you're wanting to play around with VMs with the free version of VMware or some other hypervisor, I would load it up with at least, 8's a good starting point for running some Linux VMs. You know, you don't, depending on what you're wanting to do. My previous server, home server, and I'm quoting server, air quotes around server, it was just a PC, but it was a quad core AMD with 8 gig of RAM, and I ran a couple VirtualBox VMs off of it until I upgraded it to an actual server grade motherboard. So you can, it just depends on how many VMs you're going to do and what you're planning on doing with it.
Yeah, I've got another box over here that's it's an Intel i7. It's a second generation. It's pretty old, but it's not significantly slower than anything that's produced today, I don't think. That's got 16 gigs of RAM, and that used to be that was my VM box, and I used to have up to 6 or so VMs at one time on it, Windows and Linux, and performed very well. And that's not what I was building when I built this other one. It just ended up being it's just that it turned out to be once I got that's the processor that they had, it was like, oh, now I've got to do something else.
So I'm looking on Newegg's site, and a dual port Intel NIC card is, you can get one from anywhere from $40 to $50.
That's probably what I'll end up doing at some point. I just haven't. It was like, okay, I'm going to not do that, and I end up with a complete another box, and so I'm thinking I'm going to build a NAS out of it. And this box is going to end up being a NAS, I'm pretty sure. Whether it's got a firewall built into it or not, I'm not sure yet.
Well, there again, I would separate the two. But that new box, just for instance, my home server is running a Myth TV. It's running SSH server. It's running, I've got a ZFS four drive ZFS RAID attached to it. It does everything. It serves video to the home. It does everything. So one box can do a whole lot of different things. You don't know. And it's running 2 or 3 VMs. One VM runs all the time. I start the other two up when needed. You can take a Linux and do a whole lot of things on one box.
Okay, how's that different if you said that it would be okay to run the firewall in a VM, and it's okay to run a NAS in a VM? Could they be on the same box?
Yeah, you could virtualize your router if you'd want to. I've never done it. But it's becoming, with the the way everything's being virtualized nowadays, I mean, it's becoming quite popular to do that. I think pfSense even has an image for a virtual, you know, a virtualized image you can download, if I remember correctly.
Oh, I had noticed that. That's, I actually wasn't planning to do that. It was that, that's, I was thinking that's the box, that's the hardware, and I would use, then I would virtualize the NAS.
Well, I consider my home server a NAS, but the base OS it's running right now, and the only reason I'm running a graphical interface, it's Ubuntu 16.04, so it's Ubuntu with the XFCE spin. The only reason I am running a graphical interface on that box right now is because of Myth TV. You can't run that without a desktop environment. So that's the only reason why I'm running a graphical operating system on that box right now. And it's just using the attached ZFS RAID. I'm sharing that out with Samba and NFS on the home network. So basically it's a NAS, but it's also doing virtualization and recording TV and running some VMs that I need. Actually, 90% of the time I SSH into it. I never even go out to the grid. It's out in my garage. I never even go out and, you know, interface with the desktop environment.
Actually, I had that backwards. I was thinking of the NAS as being the box, because I didn't want to if you virtualize a NAS, then the hard drives are set up as like a single file in the whole hard drive, which is pretty crazy. As far as I'm concerned, I can't think of how that makes any sense at all. And so I was going to say build a NAS and use it, hang a virtual server off of it. So that's what I was really thinking. Your setup sounds pretty good, though, as far as your NAS goes. And I don't know about sticking it in the garage. My garage is hot.
My garage is divided up and from the main two-car garage to a third car that's divided by a wall, and I actually have heating and cooling from the house ran out there to it. It's my man cave, basically, is where it's located. So, and it does get up into this, you know, it gets up to close to 80 degrees in there during the summer, even with air conditioning ran out there to it.
Ooh, the man cave. You mean like the TV, the beer commercial?
Oh, yeah, it's not that pretty. It's just it's a garage. I got a workbench and some shelving. And I do computer repair on the side, so that's where I work on computers and do all my honeydew projects and stuff like that.
Well, if I did honeydew projects, that's where I would do them too. Yeah, as long as it's reasonably cool, that's okay for. We have a 3-bedroom house, and it's just me and my wife. So we have a room, what the builder called a bedroom is what we call the computer room, and it's my room with my computers and desk and. Three computers and things like that satisfy my requirements for computer stuff in my retirement years. For the garage, I want to build a boat.
So any virtualized machine is basically a file. I don't know if you could attach your storage to a VM. that would be practical, or in how the performance would work. But NAS just stands for Network Attached Storage, and like say I just use Ubuntu or Zubuntu with a lot of storage attached to it, and so that's a network attached. It's a NAS. It doesn't. I mean, it's nothing special. Now some of these pre-made NAS distros like FreeNAS. So if you install that on the bare metal, it kind of becomes an appliance. But I do believe there are options to do other things with FreeNAS. You can actually virtualize stuff, and there's plugins and stuff you can do. But then you're limited, I think. That's what I don't like. I like to build the base from a Linux distro that I'm comfortable with and add all the services that I want it to serve myself. Then plus, if I'm out in the garage, it does have a monitor and keyboard and mouse attached to it. And if I need to look something up while I'm working on something, I can jump on it and fire up Firefox and do some web browsing.
No, I agree with you on that completely. As far as the hard drive go, in a virtual computer, the virtual hard drive is a file, or in the case, the VMware will break that down and it will divide out the hardware. Say you give it 40 gigabytes of storage, it will break that down, and I think it breaks it into 2 gigabyte pieces, but you see a 40 gigabyte hard drive and it is 22 gigabyte files. And within that, it's the VMware's version of a file system. And it's not at all ZFS or anything like that. So you don't get to choose your file system. You mentioned ZFS and for your system. And that's why I was thinking that the NAS would be the box, and the hardware would be running the file system, and then any virtual systems where there's no major disk storage requirement would hang off of that, and that might include say the router.
Is the saying we already said?
The question is, how do we know?
Hello.
I guess we know because of the massive delay I'm experiencing.
No, because you're going through there. Turn that off.
How did I turn that off?
Mongo, here's what I would suggest. On that new box, I would install whatever operating system you're familiar with. You know, if you need the GUI desktop on it, go ahead, do that. And then just download and install VirtualBox if you want to start playing around with virtualization. It offers a quick and easy way to do VM. That's what I use on my system. It's just running VirtualBox.
Well, my current, the way it's built right this minute is with Ubuntu and... So I can build a NAS on it and using Ubuntu, and I haven't got anything else on it right now.
Well, like I said, if you want to start playing around with virtualization, just download the free version of VirtualBox. So I think it's available in the package manager. And then you can just start playing around with virtual machines.
I've tried VirtualBox. Have you got any experience with KVM?
I tried it once. Got kind of frustrated with it for the learning. You know, I didn't take the time to learn it. The next time I redo this box, I will probably try it with a little bit more research up front and try to get away from VirtualBox.
I guess I like the idea of it because it's, you know, closer to the hardware, you know, being kernel based, and but I haven't actually set it up at all.
I mean, they're all the same kind of at the heart. It's just getting to know the interface of it. I didn't, like I said, I didn't do my research up front and just jumped in and thinking I could get my VMs back up and going real quickly, and it didn't work out that way, so I just jumped back on the VirtualBox because I knew it and it worked. And so, like I say, the next time I redo that box from scratch, I will probably give KVM a little bit better try.
What do you use?
Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to ask, what do you use on that box right now? What's the purpose of that particular VM?
Well, it's the VM I'm running is currently serving my Nextcloud server, a tiny RSS server, and I've got a invoicing web application called Invoice Plane that I do all my invoicing for my side business. So it's serving up three, it's running three web-based applications with Apache on it.
Regarding KVM, I've been using KVM with Proxmox and with Vert Manager in Ubuntu, and been working great. That was several years ago, though.
Okay, I'm sorry. What did you say that you're running on it?
I didn't run anything specifically on it, just some test VM or whatever. But it was very easy to handle using Vert Manager in Ubuntu or Proxmox.
Okay, I've just it just kind of made sense to me that KVM would be something that would make sense. I had tried VMbox. I mean, what's it called?
VirtualBox.
VirtualBox. Sorry, I got it mixed up. VirtualBox, and I don't remember now what it was that I ran on it, but it either didn't work or I just had some configuration problems with the setup. And it was something I had done in VMware before, and it was like, oh, wait a minute, this is a real pain in the butt, or either that or it didn't work at all. And then I was thinking, oh, wait, this is so easy in VMware, so I just probably didn't give it a good test for that reason, because I've been using VMware for so long. But I really am attempting to go to open source products and Linux and things like that. But when you know something, you got experience with something, and VMware is one of the things I've been using for a number of years, and I've got a lot of experience with it. Also, it's kind of like the granddaddy of the virtual machines, and it's very mature.
Yeah, on a desktop or laptop, I've been using VMware Player and VirtualBox and KVM in Virtual, and I don't think there's a big difference. I mean, they do, the details are different, but I think they basically do the same thing, and they feel similarly subjectively snappy and all that. So, but like you were saying, VM feels good to use because it's stream in the kernel, is as little special stuff as possible. But VirtualBox is free software too, so VirtualBox is not bad.
Yeah, I guess if what I'm doing right now was really important, I would have more it'd be more important that I get it done in some particular time frame, and that's kind of part of my problem. Part of the problem when you're retired, you kind of work on things when you're in the mood and you think about it, and you can forget something for weeks at a time without it being a big deal. And that's kind of where my router NAS project is right now.
So the virtualization you're talking about now, is that your router project? You want to run that in the virtual machine?
He's considering it.
I was originally, I had an old box that I was going to build just a PSN router. And I was frustrated by not being able to get the network cards I had working, and I decided to spend $100 and go buy some hardware. And so I bought a new box, and it turned out that it was a much more powerful server. So now, wait a minute, I've got a real piece of hardware here. I can make it do more. So now I'm thinking, well, I had planned on doing a NAS, so now I can do the NAS and the router in the same box. How would I do that? And that's kind of where I got stuck. If I had just gone out and purchased a dual NIC adapter for the original old piece of crap dual core Intel box that my brother gave me, I would have a PSense router and be happy as I could be, and not even be thinking about anything else. Instead, I've got a server here that is like just sitting here, is currently even powered off, and it's like I could, oh, it can do all sorts of stuff, and I want to do the most with it, not just you don't put a dedicated router on an 8-core processor.
Right. Now, I've been listening like with one ear, and now I see where all these threads are being tied together. So the major reason you went out and bought that new box was that because of hardware support in FreeBSD?
Yeah, it was kind of like I was frustrated over not being able to get the FreeBSD to support the NICs I had. And I knew that all I had to do was to buy the correct Intel-based NICs. But I'm hard-headed or stupid, one or the other. I'd prefer nobody clear up which it is. And I went out and bought a new motherboard and processor. And so now I have a completely, a very nice box that can do all sorts of stuff. And so now it's like a shame to also, you wouldn't want to run use as much electricity as this thing probably takes just to be a router. So I'm thinking, oh, this can be my NAS, because I really had planned to do a NAS at some point. And so how would I configure this box to be a NAS and a router?
We can just say what was a good excuse to go out and buy somewhere. But I think one way you could make use of the older thing would be to run Linux on it and then run the router in a virtual machine, just one thing in one virtual machine. The Linux could make use of the network cards and then present virtual network cards to the router. Have you considered that?
Well, actually, the most recent plan in my head is that the box would be a primary, it would boot up, it would be a NAS, and then it would also host a virtual machine that would be the router.
You mean the older hardware now?
I'm sorry, what was that?
Are you talking about the new box you bought, the old hardware you got from your brother?
No, I'm talking about exclusively just the new box. I'm not using the old box at all at this time.
Because my thought was, if you want to have a router, you probably want a physically separate box, and you probably want to use the old hardware for something. So if FreeBSD doesn't support the hardware on that box, you could still make use of the hardware by putting a VM host in between.
No, actually, that was never the problem. The problem was that I didn't go out and get the appropriate network card for the old hardware. The old box supported PS Sense and BSD perfectly. When it came up with a single network interface and did not support the additional NICs that I had added. And I knew that all I had to do was go find a Intel-based NIC and it would work. But instead, I went and bought a whole nother box. So I might not be the smartest admin around.
No, but that's what I'm saying. You could probably support Linux in that old box with a Linux VM host and then have the VertIO network cards in the FreeBSD guest.
No, I know that the box does run FreeBSD PSSense. That does
work.
Yeah,
but not supporting all the NICs you put in.
I just put the wrong ones in. I put in a couple of whatever the hell they are, that weren't Intel.
Yeah, but they're just wrong because PFSense didn't support them, right? But if your VM host could support them, that would be a solved problem.
You mean install a host and then put the PFSense in a VM?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
I never thought of that.
So in that kind of use case, a VM useful even if you're just running one VM on the physical machine, because the Linux layer could be a translation layer for the FreeBSD running on top.
Actually, that might very well work just fine. I could put any number of VM hosts. Systems on it and run PSSense on that, and who knows? Yeah, that might work. I may have to get that out of the closet just to see.
Sounds good.
So wait a minute, what am I going to do with this other damn server?
Now you can do anything you like with it.
Actually, I've still got a NAS planned. I've got 3-4 terabyte drives that are going to become my main storage, I think.
12 terabytes, that's a lot of family albums.
Yeah, a lot of dirty movies.
I would highly suggest on those three, raid those three. I would go ahead and get a fourth drive so you have four. But raid those four drives with the ZFS, and I've just switched over to ZFS here recently from Software Raid, and I love it. It's so much more reliable, I believe.
Yeah, I was going to use some kind of a RAID 5 type system. I was really only looking for 8 terabytes. I've been trying to decide on whether or not to go to ZFS or whether to stick with EXT4 for that, and I just hadn't quite decided whether or not to do that.
I would highly recommend ZFS. It just seems to be more rock solid than EXT4. Or whatever other file system from my past experience.
Performance is probably not a big deal. From what I saw, the performance is not as good as with the EXT4, but it certainly seems to be more reliable as far as I don't know, power failures and things like that, if things that happen while you're in the middle of saving files and all that sort of stuff. But my most of my experience is, of course, in Windows, and there was only one file system. You actually have choices with Linux, and so I've been trying to figure out exactly which one, and ZFS seems to be the one that is most recommended, then you go to look at, and performance-wise, it seems to be a little lower.
I would like to talk a bit about free open source hardware and what people are doing with that, and FPGAs and all that. Does anyone have any experience in that area?
Are you saying open source hardware?
Yeah, like this year, I think if it did out already, I think this year there's a RISC-V with a built FPGA coming out. Would be really cool if someone would put that on a board for people to tinker with. But otherwise, yeah, RISC-V is a processor architecture that is entirely free hardware, so anyone is allowed to modify and use it. And it's really looking like it's got a bright future. Western Digital just came out and said they're going to make all their future products use RISC-V instead of ARM or whatever, or MIPS. And then there was a discussion on the Ogcast Planet IRC channel just a few hours ago about how everyone is talking about Raspberry Pi and it's liberating people, but it's not really because nobody's building phones with it. And now XJ9 just came on the channel and you're working with your Hero Punch and Tomo OS project, which is exactly about actually creating, for among other things, your own phone, right?
Yeah, that's what we're trying to do. So the idea is we want to make, I'm calling them like DIY core devices, but it's a little bit more complicated than just like plugging pieces together. But we want to make plans for manufacturing your own smartphone in just like a sort of like a basic electronics lab, how to solder and, how to read instructions. You can manufacture your own smartphone that works together with some like mesh technologies just to create like an alternative to cell and traditional smartphone stuff, just kind of like a peer-to-peer and decentralized alternative to that, where you could just get plans and parts, manufacture your own device, and then use it on this open like mesh network.
Now, there are so many aspects that go into this. Like, first you have, okay, we've been working on software freedom for 20 or 30 years. But then, okay, if we own our software now, we can run Linux. What do we run it on? And then we start talking about free hardware. How do we control the software runs on? And then once you got that, then, like you already brought up, then there's also the topic of network freedom, which is especially acute in the US this year. So that's interesting what people are doing, building mesh networks, and how can those mesh networks connect to each other on the global scale without getting interfered with by big intermediaries.
Yeah, and even just from like an interaction perspective, like most of our systems are designed around this idea of a reliable, persistent network connection, which in a mesh type context isn't really true. Like you'll have, you can have connectivity, but it's not going to be the same as having like really expensive like cell infrastructure where they have all these towers all over the place that provide strong signals and all these things. A mesh network provided by cellular or like Raspberry Pis or cell phone type devices isn't really going to be this really reliable thing. So you have to build around that weak kind of semi-connected network infrastructure to be able to really take advantage of, or just to have like a really good experience. You have to build around that weakness where the internet it's not a fiber connection. It's an intermittent wireless connection that can have good throughput, but not necessarily all the time. So that's something that I think that the Secure Scuttlebutt team or people, consortium, whatever they call themselves, are doing really well, is because it's this lazy gossip type of architecture. So rather than trying to have like a global thing like a DHT or something like that, you can just pass messages to the next person that's also running a client. And so you don't really need to have like a connection from you to anyone else. You just have to have a hop, the ability to hop to whoever you're trying to talk to.
Yeah, so when you're on an intermittent network, it becomes really interesting to have this. The content addressed systems be interesting because you can have caches local and respond really quickly, even if you have many hops if you're going to reach all around the globe. But if you can have a local, for example, an IPFS or a secure scuttlebutt hub, then you could still have good interactivity with that for content that people are using. So that's a very interesting aspect of what we can do to get around having to have a centralized hierarchical network that provides low latency connections, the shortest path from client to server. But now I feel like it's just me and XJ9 talking here. Does anyone else have thoughts on this stuff? Have you thought about this? Like, does everyone know what secure scuttlebutt is? I hear that not everyone has heard about it. So secure scuttlebutt, or SSB, is a sort of social network protocol where it's similar to and learned from very many projects in the area. Like Twister has some similarities to it, and IPFS has some similarities to it. But basically, each node on the network is corresponding to a user and a public key and a private key. And the node and the user, when you publish a post, that post becomes the next entry in an append-only log. And this log is signed, hashed and signed, just like in Git. And when you follow people is you connect to them, and the gossip I was talking about is the nodes exchange information. Yeah, what logs have you got? Yeah, I've got these five logs. Okay, my latest message in this log is PQZ123. Yeah, I got that one, but I've got a later one that is this one. And so they can exchange information. And even if you never connect directly to the node of user XYZ, as long as you connect to other nodes, at some point connects to XYZ. So this is the intermittent part. You can securely know that they are not feeding you bogus information. So that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, I really like that. One of the kind of like the design goals for SSB was to not rely on a global distributed data structure. So that's one thing, like a DHT, it's like, it's a hash table, but it's distributed, but there's just one hash table. That's kind of like this whole swarm of like in BitTorrent or IPFS are kind of connected to.
Or Bitcoin.
So there's like the one blockchain, but in SSB, every node has its own log. So there isn't anything that's global. Like if I get a log, I get it from a specific user or node, and it's not replicated or connected to anything else other than their public key.
Yeah, so if we imagine a system, oh yeah, I guess it exists, BitMessage, where you have a central blockchain and you serialize your sequence of messages through that. That means everyone who want to participate need to basically download the whole thing or trim information. But if you just handle the logs that you are interested in, then scalability becomes a whole different game from this whole massive global state situation where you have lots of disparate states instead. And every node has its own view of the network. It's like how we see in the Fediverse that each federated has its own idea of what is the global state, depending on what users, people on that server happen to be following. Except that on SSB, every node is a single user node. So, but on the topic of free hardware, has anyone here been playing with FPGAs? I'm curious if there are any good tinker-friendly FPGA boards out there, like something that is not just the FPGA and then you'll have to figure everything out, but something sort of like the Raspberry Pi, where you have a system on chip and you have the FPGA and you can connect it to things using some kind of simple standardized interfaces. For example, ARM, I guess it's not ARM themselves. There's, I guess it's Xilinx that produces it. The Zynq processor, Z-Y-N-Q, is an ARM core that has an integrated FPGA thing. And this is actually being used in productions, in production. I'm working with some people who make embedded applications, and they use Zynq in their product because it's, even if they have quite a large volume of hardware, that they still don't want to make an ASIC, because if they have a device with an FPGA in it, that's fast enough for their purposes, and that means they can always upgrade it when they have products out in the field that they need to upgrade. So that's pretty cool. So Giralo 2, what's a vampire board? Is that a GPU or? So Giralo 2 says in the channel, it's not for tinkering specifically, but you're supposed to be able to make your own cores. Amiga emulator replaces the 68000 processor in a real machine. So is the vampire board something that is used to emulate Amigas, you mean? So instead of just running UAE on your machine, you would put in a vampire board and then program it to run as a Motorola processor? And they're saying, yeah, it replicates the CPU, but adds memory, HDMI, etc., IDs port. Okay, that's pretty cool. I think there's so many things that people could be doing with FPGAs, like for tinkering, but it seems like it's still a sort of, it's not something that has become a huge thing yet, but it could be a huge thing any year. It's like with 3D printing, there's lots of people getting into it now, but it's still lots of 3D printer talk is like, oh, this is great in the future. Some hackerspaces, 3D printers, and people are doing cool stuff there. But actually, I've never done any 3D printing myself.
I think 3D printing, well, I don't know. This is still saying it'll be good in the future. But like, if you have, like, just with like the Tomo project that I'm working on, we're planning on using 3D printers to do like to making. That is cool. Yeah, I don't know how to. I'm not very good at 3D modeling myself, but. Yeah, I think like the just I guess you need, first of all, the skills or like something to specifically to do with the 3D printer. But I mean, if you have the ability to create your own devices more easily and have kind of more tools for that kind of workflow, I think 3D printing gets more interesting, because then like I can make, I don't know, I need an IoT device. I can easily get a chip online somewhere, make an enclosure for it and program it and hook it up to my like compute mesh or link it to my mesh network or whatever. I mean, if it's easy to build something and then hook it up to the stuff that your other devices, I think there's more uses for a 3D printer than just like when you don't really have all of those pieces for making stuff that's like more custom.
It ties into this whole free everything. If you create your own network, you create your own hardware, create your own software, all of this is stuff that can be easily defined in sort of CODOR or other, depending on where you draw the line for code, but CODOR or like electronic representations. With a 3D printer, you can even provide the case for your electronics. So Giralo 2 says, I made a rocket-shaped cell phone charger of my own design. Usually I just print what I find and modify where necessary. Tinkercad.com if you don't know 3D modeling, Fusion 360, or Onshape.com if you know 3D modeling lingo. So where do people share 3D things? Is that Thingiverse that people use, or am I completely out of date referencing that? And is anyone using like online third-party services, or is 3D printing still a thing where you need to be at the printer because you're going to mess things up and you're going to have to do like 5 prototypes before you get it right? Giralo 2 says, Thingiverse is the fate of 3D models. A real good one is cults3d.com. So I guess that means, yes, I'm out of date and only people who don't actually deal with this still talk about the Thingiverse. Drillo2 says, I think Yegi.com, Y-E-G-G-I.com, is a multi-site 3D model searching site like WebSpider was.
Oh, cool. I'm going to have to add this to my Cyrix instance, if it's not already part of it.
What instance?
Cyrix.
Oh, the search with an X. Cyrix.
Yeah. Cyrix. Oh, I don't know. I don't know how to pronounce things.
I don't know if anyone knows how to pronounce things. So Cyrix, it supports plugins. Like you use it as a meta crawler, and then you can add like sub crawlers to it, or meta search engine. I mean, I thought Cyrix was like Yahtzee, that it crawls and it federates with other things that crawls, and then they just index this stuff together, and you search for it.
Oh no, it'll just like query other things, and then it's a meta search, so it just queries a bunch of stuff and then brings you all the search results. It does have a plugin for Yahtzee though, so if you want to like run a Yahtzee spider, you can hook your Cyrix instance to it, or point your Cyrix server to your Yahtzee instance, and then you'll get Yahtzee results mixed in with all your other meta search results.
So then
results.
Yahtzee is just another sub-search engine that it meta searches, basically.
Yeah.
So how is Yahtzee these days? Does it work, or is it just full of people gaming the system?
I have only started to look into it. I haven't. I've been looking into using it as a spider for my... So I have a Cyrix instance that I'm trying to get people to use, and I want to have my own spiders, but...
Jirello2 says, the thing to look for is a real of the model printed. Don't rely on a 3D view of the model as being a good print. If Thingiverse doesn't show the printed results, it's probably just someone's experiment.
That makes sense.
Now that sort of ties back to what I was saying. Like, yeah, you it looks good in 3D, but iterations you're going to have to do before you know that it actually works in reality. Jirello2 says, exactly.
So I'm not really familiar with like the 3D printing world. I'm working on it, but so do people normally like contribute back to models? Like if I printed it and I needed to make these adjustments for it to look good, do people normally like post the modified version or say give feedback to the creator, or is that, I don't know, like what is the community like around that?
Nobody knows.
Well then.
Oh, all right, now my 5-year-old sub-consultant came out of the bedroom.
Okay, so there's not really like a... Okay. So there isn't really like a Git type of like forking, branching model for 3D model. Well, I guess like you kind of do it manually, but there's not really like a... I guess tools for that kind of thing. Kind of sounds like that.
Hey, XG9, I guess you have a speech synthesis on, but I think the text in the channel will not end up in the recorded stream.
Oh,
so
okay.
You better read it out loud.
Okay. I'm going to turn off speech synthesis so that I'm on the same page then.
So Jirello2 said, on Thingiverse, you can link to the original as a courtesy. If you mod something, you repost it, but show the original... But you show the original your mod was from, then you can see the chain of changes. They're all covered by some kind of license. You can find things to print and sell. Then there's things you just print for yourself. So is that just like I'm on a web page and I link to another web page, or is there actually support for following, tracking the changes? Jirello2 says most of the site print this link that goes to a third seller that prints your thing too. But like when people create these models, is it also part of the data models what kind of material you use and so on? Because I'm assuming that affects the print as well. If you print with one kind of ABS stick and you print with another, I'm guessing would be make differences in the end product. Jirello2 says the differences are machine dependent. You put in your description what machine and what settings you use to get a successful print. With 3D, you can print the same filament a little harder, a little colder, a little faster or slower, and get very different results.
It seems like that would be something that, well, not all of it, I guess it depends on the machine, but it seems like it'd be useful to have some way to like have that type of information in a way that's usable by a machine. Because then you could like, I mean, if you're using the same machine, you could use the same settings, and you could just copy that those instructions instead of having to manually adjust them. I don't know, but.
Well, it also depends on how deterministic the machines are. I mean, it seems like many people buy a 3D printer, and then the first thing they do is start printing. All right, I'm not allowed to talk anymore.
Yeah, I guess I am assuming that 3D printers are like maybe more deterministic than they actually are. So that might be something that I need to learn more about before I can comment.
Yeah, it seems like the first thing people do when they get a 3D printer is to parse to make the 3D printer better.
Mm-hmm. Going back to like open hardware, one of the I think challenging parts of having open hardware is how expensive it is to manufacture. I mean, manufacturing silicon chips at scale is really inexpensive per unit, which is a good thing. But the problem is that in order to make it inexpensive per unit, you have to manufacture like a huge number of devices, and that itself is extremely expensive. So like it creates this kind of, I guess, I don't know, it creates a problem because we want to have open hardware that we can hack on and do whatever we want with. But at the same time, we need to have access to like hundreds of thousands of dollars or more to be able to fabricate these devices that we can have something to control and hack on. So there's kind of this, I don't know, like, and it's a problem because how do we also just with designing them, like it takes a huge amount of expertise and you need other expensive hardware to design your expensive hardware. So it's, I don't know, there's all these like really expensive parts to it that make it difficult, I guess. And I guess maybe that's why we're not there yet, is it's just really difficult to make open hardware unless you're already a hardware company. And most of them are, I mean, it's all basically all proprietary at this point, but it's just really like a difficult thing to get into if you don't already have the facilities to manufacture the stuff with. And that's kind of what we're trying to figure out. We don't have a solution yet, but that's kind of what we're trying to figure out with Hero Punch, it's an open source project, but we're trying to figure out how to do that. We're using Raspberry Pi as kind of the basic compute board for our first try, but it would be cool if somehow in the future we could build like RISC-V devices or something that, and maybe do something like a crowd sale or some way to rate, to kind of like pull together the money that it would take to do a production run of some open device. Because if we like come together and like, hey, well, let's print like 1,000 or I don't know what the number is, but more than 1,000 of some board, then it could be really cheap. Like we could all get $30 custom RISC-V boards that are like a Raspberry Pi but more open. But we'd need to have a lot of us come together and order them all at once in order to get that, to get the cost down to something reasonable. Or, I mean, the other alternative is we can try to figure out how to 3D print a silicon fab, and then we wouldn't need the expensive production run thing.
But that's also a question, how generic and how fast and how cheap can you make FPGAs?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, FPGA would be a whole different ballgame because, I mean, if assuming it can replace CPUs, like you just have to be able to manufacture one type of chip, and then you can do basically anything with it.
Can you hear my audio?
Yes.
Isn't Arduino open hardware?
I think so.
And they succeeded through education, pretty much, and schools and stuff, kind of like Raspberry Pi?
Yeah.
So maybe you need to put some kind of STEM program together for your particular FPGA stuff.
That's a good idea.
Wasn't there an OS like Haiku or something that had FPGA support in the OS? Or was that one of the sort of new Amiga computers type thing?
I don't think Haiku has that. That sounds like something that an Amiga project would have in it, though.
Wasn't the Haiku tie-in, though, the PowerPC architecture, not necessarily Amiga or FPGA? I think it runs on Amiga hardware or something.
Haiku? Haiku is just...
I could be wrong.
It's based on an open source version of a Haiku kernel, but that was for x86.
I must be thinking of something else.
I think there's a lot of overlap between the Haiku and Amiga communities. And both of them come from, the new Amigas, beyond the actual commercial Amigas, they were on PowerPC. So I think there are Amiga intended platforms that can also run Haiku OS. I could be wrong about that.
Yeah, Amiga is using the PowerPC because of the Indian-ness, and I can't remember which is which, but x86 is either Bigger Little Indian, and the Amiga OS is the opposite. And that's why they're not going to re-engineer the whole stack just to run on x86. From what I understand, part of the problem of the new Amiga stuff is they keep trying to run it on PowerPC type architecture. And I think there was only one manufacturer left, and they're so expensive to get the hardware that it's just not feasible unless you just really, really have to have it.
But what about that new Power laptop?
You mean the 3D printed Amiga laptop? Fireworks are starting here. I didn't understand that.
Can you hear me now?
Very choppy. You're on Wi-Fi or hardwired? DoD Dummy posted from MorphOS site just-in-time compiler that emulates a 68K family of processors and thereby allows to transparently execute legacy applications developed for the Commodore AX00 series of computers. You'll find a selection of core components described below, but they list only PowerPC architectures. I'm not familiar with MorphOS. I just kind of follow the original Amiga stuff. Not sure, but I think it was the Amp Hour podcast I was listening to, and they had an interview with someone that was talking about FPGA, and there are a few products that you use every day that are actually FPGA because they're easier to reproduce, I guess, across a bunch of different platforms or circuit boards or something. So there's some companies out there that are just FPGAing chips that are too expensive to put together in a set, I guess. I don't know.
Them to get like so common that somebody can make something like a Raspberry Pi, because like the Raspberry Pi is really just like something that Broadcom just makes a lot of these chipsets, so it was just cheap and easy to put together in like an educational board.
Yeah, I think the idea was instead of buying, let's say, 5 different chips, get your main chip emulated and then emulate the other 4 chips in that one chip, then you buy one FPGA, and that turned out cheaper to do than to buy the 5 chips and put them on board.
Mm-hmm.
Which may be sad in the future if you take your stuff apart and you're going to find an FPGA and it'll be locked down, and as soon as you try to reverse engineer it, it locks up on you.
Oh, that would be sad.
Do you watch CNXsoftware.com? They usually have reviews of new boards coming out.
Could you post a link to that? CNXsoftware.com?
Or just yeah, it's CNX dash.
Oh, sorry. Dash. Okay. Nope. Oh, cool. I'm gonna watch it now.
I just looked for FPGA, and this is the first one that came up. Mellon S3 FPGA Arduino and Raspberry Pi compatible board is programmable over Wi-Fi using ESP8266 WISOC.
Oh my god.
500,000 gates. This one looks cool. It's an Arduino size FPGA setup. Funny news from 2011.
Oh.
And for more board clacking, tune into the Board Podcast on YouTube. That's a fun project. You can build your own clacky keyboard. Happy New Year, Hawaii. Happy New Year. Does anybody have a Steam link? So is it bad that none of the RISC-V cores have passed their compliance suite? Did everybody fall asleep?
Oh, I've just been quiet.
Did you say you were doing stuff with BSD now?
So how far is the new year gone?
I'm in 42 minutes. Do they do Australia first?
I don't know. I was late to the party.
So you're still here, Netminer?
Yeah, I'm still here. When they do silence compression, they're going to save a lot of space.
Yeah, exactly. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Now I just got to dig up that calendar that I tucked away last year.
Only a few more to go. Alaska is the last U.S. No, still some more U.S. states to go. Time for coffee. That's what we say. Time for coffee.
I don't know, I'm in Hawaii and I'm 45 minutes in, so there's no more US stuff. Don't they do Australia and New Zealand first?
According to the timeanddate.com counters multicountdown.html, we've got Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, and Unalaska going in 14 minutes. Then French Polynesia in 45 minutes. Two small regions of US. Honolulu, Pohnpei, America, Samoa will be then going an hour later with Pogo Pogo.
Honolulu was 45 minutes ago.
Was it? Okay.
Yeah. Because I'm here. That's where I am. Well, not Honolulu, but Kona, Big Island. Same time zone.
Honolulu. Is that the same one?
That's Hawaii. That's where I am.
Well, time of day, Delta. Well, same 1 hour.
Maybe Marshall Islands?
Here's me arguing with somebody who's actually there. Okay, here's a... are you on the chat? Yes, obviously you are. Hold on. So what's wrong with that?
Here in Boston, it's a balmy 1 degree. Feels like 15 below.
We're UTC minus 10 here.
Okay. That's weird. So suddenly my faith in timeanddate.com has just disappeared. Anyway,
so we'll keep I don't know going. Where Baker Island and Howland Island, I don't know where that is, but that's supposed to be a U.S. minor outlying island. That's probably the final mark, the three-hour deal. Yeah, it says hour 12 Honolulu, but we're on HST. I don't know what HAST is.
According to DuckDuckGo, the time in Baker Island, an U.S. minor outlying island, is 8:47 p.m. Let's see what it thinks Honolulu is. Maybe you got it wrong. You have to go out and tell all your neighbors, go back in, it'll be another hour. Okay. Time in Honolulu, United States, is 10:48 p.m. on Sunday, the 31st of December, 2017. Am I doing something wrong? Could be the time settings on my clock.
I guess my computer time is wrong because I'm showing Hawaii Aleutian time, 10:49, so 10:50 roughly. Got a long way to go. My computer says it's 12:49 a.m. The clock on the wall says 10:50.
Okay. Right, the only solution to this is coffee.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, crazy.
So you're still on fresh ground, I hope.
Yeah, I got 10:49 according to Google.
You know what it is? I think it's my VPNing has screwed me up. I'm using the wrong time zone for the VPN, and somehow things got reset.
Well, I think with the forecast, the high today is supposed to be 15 degrees, 14 degrees, depending on who you listen to. And there's a wind chill advisory until 10 o'clock in the morning. So I think I'll be out here until the close of the new year. And then I'm going to crash and bury myself under the cover.
Damn that, Ken. Right again.
Gentlemen, my brother in Missoula, Montana, has a balmy 16 degrees. Boston area is colder than Montana. And it's going to be warmer today.
I went for a bike ride last week and it was 65. I had to put a jacket on.
Well, I think I'm going to have the first meal of the year.
Okay, got coffee.
Well, I'm going to have, I guess you'd call it breakfast. First meal of 2 days, and although this was used to be my favorite lunchtime when I was doing midnight date security.
Are you working right now?
I'm on disability, thank goodness.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
It protected my house and a small retirement saving, a very small and shrinking retirement saving.
Yeah, they've just moved up the retirement age over here as well. Did you get any sleep?
That's why I wasn't on during the middle of the day.
Aha. I must have missed that. So you're operating in UTC time zone then?
One of the many pills that I'll be taking is for anxiety nightmares, so sleep and I are old enemies.
Not good. Oh, dear, dear. I'm just wondering, should I restart soldering this PCB now? Yeah, it might be a good idea.
That voice sounds familiar. Does Terrible Fire mean anything?
No.
That's a fellow on YouTube who does open source hardware upgrades for, I think, Amigas.
Oh, yeah?
Some of his stuff will work on Ataris, too. Yeah, he's got an Amiga 500 board that puts on 68030, and he's working up towards a 68040 board.
That seems like something that would be right up my alley. What's his handle again?
On YouTube, it's Terrible Fire. And unfortunately, I don't remember where he's actually located, but he is in Europe. He's in the UK.
Yeah, got the link. I'll put it into the show notes. Yeah, he subscribes to the EVBug and Retro Caveman, Modern Vintage Gamer. Let's have a look. Although I must say I'm not that into the Atari. Never could afford one, to be honest.
Well, if you ever want to know how to handle surface mount devices.
Oh, he digs me. He shoots, he scores. Did they have surface mount devices back then?
No, but they have them today, and he... he fights with them, and he thinks they're easy.
Oh, okay.
Yes, and he's a rather sober fellow, so it's just a point of view. Surface mount devices, CPLDs, I don't know. My claim to fame is designing two touch-tone interfaces for a PDP-11. One of them used MUXes, and one of them used tri-state devices. And the touch-tone interface was stolen off of a board that we were already creating, because the touch-tone interfacing to this switch capacitor decoder was very black magic.
Wow, there's a short right there. Sorry to be... to be repeating myself, but seriously, do a few shows on this.
Besides, you may want to steal one of his IDE interfaces or his interface to... he's doing some work on putting a SATA interface on one of his cards and stuff like that.
Okay. I think I'll be happy if I get my component tester working, to be honest.
Everybody's got to start somewhere except me.
Seriously, I think I burnt them last night trying to mess with them so much. I would be shocked if this thing worked. Still, it was a learning experience. They're on there.
If you touch it wrong, you're going to get shocked anyway.
Yeah. Well, hardly with DC voltage. A 9-volt DC. So what's next? Resistors, capacitors, or transistors? I think resistors, they're smaller. Yeah, we'll do resistors. Oh, wife's awake. Back in a minute.
Yeah, the only hardware that I do is, so far, is x86, and that's the reason I got my single-core E-Machines box, was to give me a more modern machine than my P4 single-core. I was going to do some hardware swapping around, and I figured to do it better on an expendable machine, and then learn how to put in modern hard drives and stuff. Had a little problem with the first build, though. Evidently, the card that I put in used the same chipset as on board with the same vectors and the same bio.
Okay, I got official permission to solder this thing.
Who'd you have to check with?
She who rules my life voluntarily. My wife, the person who does the intro and outros.
Happy New Year, my lady.
Yeah, she's out in the other room. Yes. Okay, so let's see what we have here.
Well, tell her she could have improved the show considerably.
Manon, you could have improved the show considerably. I doubt that. I really like listening to the New Year show.
Yes, but the ladies do improve the neighborhood.
Indeed.
You said Marilyn? That's my mother's. That was my mother's name.
Yeah, her name is Manon. It's from French. There's a book called Manon, the Source. My mother-in-law was reading it, apparently, at the time. She was pregnant.
Well, yeah, one of the ladies I was doing some business with was Noelle, because she was supposed to be delivered on Christmas.
Yeah.
Her birthday is January 10th.
Yeah, very good. I'm named Kenneth because my mother was expecting a girl, and then she named me after the baby who was in the bed next to her. In fairness to her, she already had three boys, so she probably ran out of names by that stage. And truth be told, the lady who was in the bed next to her was also a good friend, so...
Yeah, the only female I have to look up to right here is a cat.
There's a lot of those around.
Well, this one is a tuxedo cat female. Tuxedo cats are known to be a little crazy. And I do believe that there's serious problems with the education system around here.
How so? Do we go from cats
well,
to that?
Well, when I was a kid, they taught me
cat
about
education?
They taught me about pussycats. This one is a pushy cat.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I think the spelling should be changed.
Very good.
If we're going to be politically correct, pushy cat is definitely the one. Also, when I was transitioning, my mother was in the nursing home, and the title of the property hadn't transitioned to into my name, I called the utility company up, and they said, all right, you're not a tenant, you're not the homeowner. Can I put you in for property manager? And I said, yes. Do you know anyone who'll cash a check for a cat?
Did they find that amusing?
Well, it was the best I could do at the time. My mother just having gone into a nursing home.
Yeah, exactly. Times like these, knowing the color bands on a resistor would help. However, with the 5-band resistors, it's hard to tell which one, where to start. Is it orange, orange, black, red, brown, or brown, red, black, orange, orange? Or do I just switch on my multimeter and measure it? Yep, multimeter switchy on. Check it. Thank you.
Yeah, my dad tried to teach me that stuff back in the day, but it didn't really take.
This is where a component tester would be very handy. 33K, apparently, that one. Now, let's see, do the colors match up?
Bad boys ruin our young girls.
Whoa, thank you. Let me write that down.
Which translates to black, brown, red, orange, yellow, green.
What about blue, violet, gray?
I don't remember that part. Those are not usually something I use.
Black boys ruin our... No, bad boys, as that would be inappropriate. Was it bad boys?
Yeah, it's inappropriate enough. Bad boys ruin our young girls.
It is bad enough.
Well, my electronics teacher was an old Navy guy, so, you know, that's where that comes from.
That, sir, has just given me one of the questions in my ham radio exam. Thank you very much.
I have an old Navy... story that I picked up on the USS Massachusetts.
Hit me.
Well, the Navy had equipped the ships with low-power radio transmitters to teach the, you know, young sailors Morse code and Navy procedures and all that good stuff without necessarily going using the main transmitters. Well, a lot of the radio men were, of course, amateur radio operators from civilian life.
Yeah.
So what happened was that they got together and they formed an unofficial network when the stuff wasn't being used for instruction.
Uh-huh.
And somebody twigged that the radio direction finders were finding unauthorized transmitters being operated in the Bay Area, wherever this was at the time. And the guy said that the last thing that he transmitted was, "This station is shutting down permanently."
Cool. And were they on ships now, or were they on naval bases?
They were on ships, and the ships, the whole, you know, they had practice transmitters or training transmitters added in addition to the main units.
Ah, right, yeah, yeah.
And just like in universities where there's an unattended computer and hackers around, people tend to gravitate and start using them.
Oh, yes, they will do that, all right.
Looks like I gave you the clean version.
Okay, that's great. I know what I'm going to do the rest of the day, so look up anagrams for this.
The end of that is for the blues, but violet goes willingly. So bad boys ruin our young girls, but violet goes willingly.
Oh, dear, yes. Great. And apparently it's orange, orange, black, red, brown. Orange, orange, black, red, brown. 33K. I am going to be here the whole freaking day doing this. Found it.
Well, basically, if you see black or brown, that's the end you start with. The other end is going to be white, gold, or silver. Maybe gray, and that's the tail end.
Who's talking there?
Jerulo 2. Hi.
Have we met before?
I'm Jerulo on the HPR and IRC and elsewhere.
Nice to meet you.
Yeah, good to talk to you.
Cool. Quikey, the weekends really bring out the people here. This is cool.
Ah, yes, the Vim is my IDE thing.
Yeah, that was a while ago.
Yeah, exactly.
It's okay, I heard my name on the review show the other day. On a Cloud 2 comment.
Oh, yeah, yeah, your show is about the Omega 2. Did you ever get one? Kickstarter Omega 2 Plus first time setup walkthrough. Obviously you did.
Yeah, I had a fish tank then. I don't have a fish tank now. I was going to put the temperature gauge on it.
Oh, and yeah. Track it. So how did that go?
Never got that far.
Yeah. Yet.
I'm on to OpenHAB. I want to set up the OpenHAB so I can control my Sonoff switches.
Okay, that's one. So what were you saying? Look for the darker colors and then work from there.
Oh, yeah. The black and the brown are going to be the starting end. And the tail end is going to be gold or white or yellow. Not yellow. Gold or white or gold.
This one looks yellow. So brown, orange, black, purple. Let me think.
And sometimes you won't even have the gold or the silver mark. That just tells you the tolerance if it's a 1% resistor or a 5%.
Yeah, I'm not that concerned.
But as far as knowing which end to start from, it's going to be the brown or the black or the red, usually.
So I'm reckoning this is a... So brown is there, so that's going to be 2. Orange is... Hold on, let me work through it.
Oh, there's another tell. If there's a gap between some of them, there's going to be a larger gap on the end.
Yeah.
The beginning will have no gap.
Yeah, but then the brown has a massive gap over to the orange, which is 2, 3... 2, 3, 1 violet. 2, 3, 1, 7. What does that mean? No, 2, 3, 0, 7. And it looks purple. Is that violet then, I'm guessing? Let's measure it and see.
If it's not blue, it's violet.
2, 3, that's okay, but okay, we'll see.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to get rid of several pounds of tubes and a few nasty CRTs.
Well, it seems a shame throwing that stuff away now. It's getting so rare.
Well, unfortunately, I have no way of passing it on to people who might use it.
There's no, like, free cycle or something like that?
Not that I know of in this area.
Well, it'd be no harm contacting one of the museum guys and see. Well, put a call on HBR and see if anybody... will be able to help us. So 237 is 20 mega ohm. Is that a thing? 23 mega ohm.
Could be. You've got violet in the fourth position. Position 4 is a multiplier.
Yeah, and push to talk wasn't on, so you didn't get any of that. I thought it was very insightful.
Nope.
So it's brown, orange, black, violet, and then yellow. And looking at the thing for 23 mega ohms is red, orange, black, green. Is completely wrong.
What was the fourth color?
It's like violet. Right? It could be the other way. It could be, let me see, violet. Yeah, maybe it is. Yellow, violet, black, and then...
You got a kit, and that was in your kit?
Yep.
I can imagine what a mega ohm resistor would be used for in that kit.
Yeah, so it could be the other one. Maybe
it's 13K, not 13 meg.
Or it could go the other way, 47 something.
Oh, it could be 47K, that's common.
470, and then...
470 ohm?
Let me see, 470, and then orange, 3.
47K.
47K. Oh, let me measure that. Why did I get that wrong? This makes great radio, it has to be said.
Today on the BBC, you're listening to Ken as he puts in resistors.
Now my DVM at 20K, my DVM is measuring...
Put it up to 100K and what is it?
200K, it measures something and then goes to 1. I'm putting it to 20 meg. 0.47. That's strange. 0.47 mega ohms is 470 kilo ohms?
Correct.
That's not my thing. This is why. And now I'm piping that into a resistor thing, and that says, indeed...
Do you have a mega ohm range, or does it just go 10 meg?
It goes 20 mega ohm, but then when
so
it...
So 20 meg, it's 0.47...
mega ohms.
Okay.
So the 470 kilo ohm at 1% is Drum roll, please. Yellow, violet, correct.
Yellow, violet, black.
Yeah, and then we have orange and brown. That's exactly what we have. Gee, thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I will now.
Oh, you've got brown on the end. That is weird.
Yeah, brown on the end because it's a 1%. Yeah, so that sucks. So these are 470 kilo ohms. Please hold while I put them onto the board.
That's strange that you'd have 1% resistors in a kit like that.
Yeah, but they're so cheap now, that's all they send. Whether they're 1% or not is another question, but people will buy the 1% because, ooh, it's 1%. So let's take these 15% ones and just sell them as 1%. Why don't we? Do you build a lot of kits yourself?
Not so much kits. I mess around with Arduino stuff and ESP266.
Yeah, I'm seeing an awful lot about that. I'm surprised we haven't had more shows, actually.
There's never a solid workflow. It's every time you mess with it, it's different. So there's not really like a format or a plan. You have to lay out a script, basically, of procedures to do a particular thing to make a show out of it.
A general introduction would be cool, though.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was trying to do with the Omega thing, being that it was a Kickstarter and then news and stuff.
Okay, we're all gone. Join us after the break for the next Ken Looks for a Resistor. Okay, these ones are very common because there's 6 of them in there. And it's either brown, black, black, red, brown, or brown, red, space, black, black, brown. That's bizarre. Okay, so...
The 1K or 10K?
Oh, you're cheating now. How am I supposed to learn this if you don't give me the time? Black, bad boys ruin our young girls, but violet goes...
Yeah, you probably don't want to look up the real way that goes.
No. I will leave that as an exercise for the listener. Okay, so it's 1-something. Yeah, 1-2 or 1-0. More likely 1-0-something, we're guessing. 1-0-0, red, 2. 1-0-0. So the 2 is a multiplier, so 1-0-0-0-0. How many zeros is that? 1-0-0. So 10K. Place your bets, folks. Place your bets. Yes, 10K! This is a surprising amount of fun.
I think LED stuff, you always have like a 470 ohm or 220 ohm in series to limit the current for like a single diode LED for the small stuff.
This is like for an Arduino Mega, something based around an Arduino, so...
Oh, it's actually got an Arduino in it?
Yep. It's a transistor tester. If you go look at the show notes, you can see the link. I'll find it for you, hold on.
I was lazy, I think I bought like a $5 one that was already put together.
Yes, but maybe I like that pain of making tea. Let me see... It's not there. Actually, I don't know if I put it in there.
That is a reference I do know.
Do you know? Watch Father Ted.
Yeah, miss those guys.
Yeah, exactly.
I can't really watch the single guy by himself. It's not the same.
No. This would be an ecumenical matter. Do you have Irish descent? Or I'm just wondering how accessible is that if you're not Irish?
Oh, no. I was just thinking of the Linux Outlaws.
Oh, right. And the reference to them comes from Father Ted. So
that I did not know.
It was a Irish TV series about some priests who were so bad at their job that they got sent out to an island off the coast of Ireland somewhere. But the island is so crappy that one half of it fell off into the sea. Nobody noticed.
Oh, great!
It's just really, really, really bizarre, but very, very accurate. Depiction of Ireland at that time.
My grandmother was 100% Irish.
Yeah.
She married an Italian boy in New York City.
Ah, very nice. Well, at least he's Catholic. You can just hear the
parents. I'm sure that was the thing.
Yeah, exactly. how are we doing? 10K resist. No, we're looking up the board. That's what we're looking at. Actually, I can go one better. I have a video of somebody putting it together. Let me post that into the show notes.
$23.94?
It'll blow your ears out just when you're turning it off, just for your information.
I definitely like the NY Bill meter talk.
Very much so. And this is exactly why I bought it.
Do you watch the EEB blog?
Or yeah,
the EEB blog?
I've started watching it on the train, so I'm watching 3 or 4 episodes per day. So I've gone back. I'm currently at 2014, so don't ruin it for me.
He also does the Amp Hour podcast with another guy.
Yes, true.
That's just pretty good.
Is that news or chat, or is it worth listening to?
It's mostly electronics talk, so it's things happening in the electronics industry. Like Dave will talk about the meter he's building and the progress and what's going on next, and sometimes they'll have interviews of people in the industry, but it's like engineers or, you know, people building a certain thing or some particular technology.
Oh, cool. I don't think I'm ready for that yet.
And then sometimes it's just them catching up over what's happened the last time they talked. But it's audio. Dave's normal show is the video, and then this other one's audio, as far as I know.
And do they... there wouldn't be a lot of point going back to the start of those, would there?
Depending on your podcast player, I would look through the list and just download the ones that you think look interesting.
Okay.
Sometimes Dave isn't on it at all, and they'll have an interview. So one of the guys I talked to, I don't know, a month or so ago, actually, I think he used to work for a company in California, and all these guys switch jobs like every other year. And I think this guy moved to, I don't know, India or Indonesia, somewhere east, and he works on a farm, and he's trying to get technology into the hands of farmers, but, you know, inexpensive DIY kind of technology like the ESP8266 and stuff like that, and trying to build useful projects out of it. He did some kind of thing for, I think, the sewage waste company that does sewage in Egypt, where they go to the houses and they pump out the sewage and they have to take it somewhere. And so he made a thing for tracking the trucks, because what was happening is the guys driving the trucks would just take it and dump it in the river, which they're not supposed to do. And so they needed a way to track that. And I think it was something to do with the UN collaboration as well. So, you know, this, you know, one engineer guy got this opportunity to go work in Egypt to do this special project that's, you know, world influencing. And, you know, he does his own stuff independently now in other countries. So always interesting people.
Oh, very nice. Seems like right up my alley. Cool. Thanks.
Hi, guys. Can you hear me?
Can indeed, sir.
Hello, Ken. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Tony. Nice to catch up.
Thank you. So what's going on at this time of the morning on New Year's Day when everyone's probably recovering from hangovers?
It's riveting stuff here. We're going through the colours of resistors as I put in a resistor test. You remember that MI Bill did a show on a component tester some time back?
Yeah.
And I got one. And in order to... not only was I out the expense of the kit, I bought a new soldering iron with two heads, all sorts of tips for it, magnifying glasses.
I was solder. Hearing your story of that on the review show last night when I was listening to it.
What does the knob do?
It controls the menu, apparently. It's a function generator as well, and if you fast forward to the end of that video, it'll show you, and you can do self-calibration.
Okay, so I got the like $7 one. It doesn't do any of that stuff. It just, you plug in whatever and it tells you what it is. But function generator would be cool.
Yeah. You know what I really would like is an episode on is, I have like one of these, hold on one sec, I'll get it. I've got one of these Bitscope micro things, right, which is a USB crappy
that's
thing.
Yeah, perfect for that.
Yeah, but here's the thing. I got one of those too. You do, dear. And everybody else is going, oh my God, he's just fallen for this. But I have one of these things, right? And I was thinking, this is a basic introduction to an oscilloscope. Yeah. It's around $100 and it can do stuff. So
it's got leads, a bunch of leads on it, all kinds of fun stuff.
So I got this thing, right? And I plugged it in and I got it working on my Linux machine and on my Raspberry Pi. No problem. And I'm sitting there. I have no clue what to test with this, how to work an oscilloscope. Is, you know, the way that in the, so I was thinking maybe if we say, okay, people go out and buy this, this BitScope thing, and then you can follow a series of tutorials on it. But, you know, unfortunately, I haven't been able to find a host who would be able to do a series on that.
Ah, I see your point.
As well. I just think it's funny what Tony said in a way, because I just woke up and about 5 minutes ago, but I'm definitely not doing what you just said, because I didn't actually have any alcohol this New Year, believe it or not. Not that big on alcohol anyway.
Hi, Seb. Happy New Year.
Yes, Happy New Year. Also, who is Tony anyway?
Hi, I'm Tony H 1212. I've done a few shows on the HPR site.
I think a few shows might be a little bit modest.
Very,
Tony.
Very familiar voice.
Yeah.
You saved our butt a few times this year. Thank you very much for that.
You're welcome, Ken. I enjoy it as usual.
So going back to the transistor testing and oscilloscope. Is that like something that, because for the ham radio, we have recommended a cheap ham radio, which is probably not what people are going to end up with, but to get to the function of the thing, where Mr. X has done a series on how to use the radio, how to turn it on and that sort of thing. And then you've got the Ham Radio Club are doing the extension of that. It would be nice for an electronics show. That, you know, you get this BitScope. It's never going to be the one that you're going to rely on professionally, but to get an idea of the concepts, that might be useful. What, you know, what could you measure with that?
Well, I have to look at the range of it, but the thing about those is you can kind of make your own logic analyzer. You could, at the very minimum, you could just use it as a multimeter.
Yeah, what I was thinking of was, say you had an Arduino or a Raspberry Pi and one of these BitScopes. Could you do something like pulse width modulation and then be able to show somebody how run this program on the Arduino, connect to pin 1 and 2 with these leads, and then this is how you can tune it on your, you know, the BitScope to see it. That's kind of where I was going.
Yeah, that's essentially using it as a multimeter. So as you see the pulse width modulation, you can key on that signal, and when it follows a certain period over a certain time, you can set it up to capture a certain period of time on that particular line, and that's what your BitScope is showing you. Or if you just connect the lead to something between something and ground, and you turn the bit on or the bit off, you can see it go up 5 volts or go to zero. And you just see the line go up to the 5-volt mark, or it's at the bottom. You know, little stuff like that.
That would be absolutely super to do. It would be absolutely super to do.
The really cool thing about the BitScope, though, is you plug it into a Raspberry Pi, and then you go over to your laptop or your other computer, and you look at the live display of what it's measuring on your other computer, so you can do other things.
That is cool, but you cannot, yeah, but you can also display it on the Raspberry Pi.
Correct.
Yeah.
And those BitScope guys, they really know what they're doing. If you follow Arduino stuff or Raspberry Pi stuff on Google+, every once in a while you'll see a posting about they're taking, you know, 15 BitScopes and 15 Raspberry Pis and making something out of it. And they make this, you know, big giant whatever. So they're constantly doing stuff and improving their deal. So I think it's a pretty good company.
Now, is that the company that makes the dual Pi mounts and stuff?
Yeah, I think that's the one.
Let's just pop a link into the thing. Let me do that.
So you can have like a rack of like a double or quadruple Raspberry Pi scope setup, basically.
But that would be something I'd like the electronic engineers on the network and my build perhaps to collaborate on. And you know, just do a, here's a Raspberry Pi, here's an Arduino program that pulls this something, and then you can change this value by turning a dial on your Arduino or a potentiometer on your Arduino, and then you see it to the bit scope on your Pi. That would be just so awesome as a basic introduction. But far be it from me to pressure anybody into doing a show.
You'd never absolutely do that, not, would you?
Me? Gosh, no.
Cool. Here you go.
The trick is to getting that to come through over audio.
Yes, but if Dave and Beezy can do something on AUK, then this should be easy peasy lemon squeezy. And you also can put in screenshots into the show notes. And it could be supporting audio from the video.
That's true.
And it's a challenge. I mean, look at this. We're doing a live PCB construction thing, and people are following along without any problem.
That's right. We've got Transistor Hunting 101 show right there. My kit just has the plain Jane LCD. This one actually looks like it's got pixels.
Cool. Now, so all the 10Ks are in. Now, let me see. The next most common one are these. There's three of them. And contestants, stand by your keyboards.
So are you doing all the close to the board stuff first?
Yeah, exactly. I've done the insanely, ludicrously small chip. Like, this thing is tiny. And there's a capacitor that is so tombstoned, it's virtually vertical, but apparently it's fine. But the microchip was unbelievable. Six little connectors, each like less than a millimeter apart, and trying to do it with a regular solder stick. But I traced with a continuity tester, easy for you to say, from each of the pin, the top of each of the pins right down to where it should be, and it seems okay, but I may have burnt the chip into toast.
Did you pre-tin all the leads?
Yep, and the pads.
Yeah, that should be good.
Yeah, but it went all over the shop, seriously.
Just make sure and alcohol it and scrub it with a plastic bristle brush when you're done.
Oh, okay. I'll try that. Yeah, but from the top of the chip down to, you know, a pad where it's following the traces, it seems okay. So I'm pretty confident it's okay. But what I'm not confident about is that I got pin zero, pin one correct.
Pin one is by the dot or the notch.
You'd think if there was a natural effect, a dot or a notch. The only thing I can find on the data sheet is there are no burrs or production artifacts on sides E and D1. So I'm hoping for the best.
That's not cryptic at all.
Nope. But it actually was. I think it's okay. What's the worst that could happen?
Okay, now it's Happy New Year. There's lots of firecrackers going off now.
Yeah, yeah. That's what time of date. So apparently timeofdate.com knows better than you what time zone it is. Are you there on vacation or
something? No, I think my VPN messed me up because I was set to Pacific time for some reason, which is not this time. It's HST, and I don't know what happened. Okay, I was looking at my computer.
I am now.
My clock is in the kitchen.
I am now awarding you the Hacker of the Night contest for somebody who is so plugged into the net that relies on the computer time zone over the time on the wall. It's whatever time I say it is. Damn it.
Yeah, that should be an XKCD cartoon somewhere.
Yeah, probably. So, we have blue, brown, black, gold, something.
That sounds like gunshots.
Go that loud, because I can hear them.
Yeah.
I'm in a wood building, downtown.
No need to panic. You're fine.
They do have the nice no fireworks on premises signs everywhere, so maybe that'll save us.
Yeah. You didn't say nothing about gunshots, son. Let me see. Blue, gold.
Gold is going to be a tolerance.
Yeah, but it seriously is like it's this, either the second band or the fourth band.
I posted a graphic in the chat.
No, no, I got it. I got it. Don't, I see the graphic just because it's not your fault. It's definitely my fault. Okay, that last one is...
Venus Flytrap is on Limitless. Never noticed that. Did you ever watch WKRP in Cincinnati?
No, no idea what you're talking about. Is there a gray? Sounds like.
So this eBay link on the notes for HPR.
Yep.
Under shipping, it says, does not ship to the United States on eBay.
Wow.
Because I'm in Hawaii. Last I checked, this was the United States. Oh well, no accounting for eBay.
Could be gray. That'll still be odd though. Blue, gray, black, gold, perhaps?
Gray would be 8. Silver would be tolerance. Gold, silver, and none are tolerance.
Six, eight, zero, 68 ohms. Let's check that.
68 ohms would be 068. That'd be 680 something.
678?
That would be very odd.
Six 80 ohms, they reckon, is blue, gray, black.
Blue, gray, black.
Blue, gray, black, and another black. Yep.
680 ohms. Even. Very good.
Let's see if there's any on this board. Yep, 680
ohms. Is that near the LCD?
Right there. Yeah, no, they're on the... on the pads going down to the... Oh, let me see.
Maybe the power light?
Do you know what I have, actually? Is I have a scan of this board. Let me pop that up for you.
I can't see it on the listing.
No, I've got a good scan here that I actually put into the scanner and edited and flipped the back of the board, so it's mirror image. But where did I put it? That's the question. Yeah, found it. Hold on. So, Tony, are you going to odd camp this year? Do we know where it is?
I've heard rumours that it's somewhere in the northeast, but there's nothing to confirm that yet.
Around about north, south, east, Liverpoolish?
No, that's west.
Oh, yeah, okay. That's true. Yeah, it will be west.
No, think more Yorkshire area somewhere, but
Yorkshire.
But I can't say any more than that because it was an unofficial hint. But yes, I am planning to go if it's where I think it's going to be.
Is it easy to get to by plane?
Possibly, actually. Yeah, from your neck of the woods, it should be fairly easy to get to. There's a regional airport over that way.
Okay, good to know.
So what about yourself? Are you thinking you might make it over?
Well, I've decided to give FOSDEM a miss this year. It's just too much work, and I have too much stuff on with those weekends. I need to check out secondary schools for my son and daughter. So there's open days all over the shop. So I'm not going to be able to get to it this year, unfortunately.
Right.
So that leaves me a whole year without seeing Dave's beautiful mug. So I can't possibly have that.
So you'll have to come over and set up the HPR stand then.
I may have to do that. I'm actually thinking of just not bothering interviewing and just sitting there. That would be awesome.
You'll never do it.
No, that's true. You know me too well.
You'll never do it. as soon as you start seeing faces and go, I need them for the podcast.
Oh, that's
I need
cool.
them for the podcast.
We had put in a thing into Fustem, actually, to do a podcasters table, you know, a collaboration with all the open source, free Libre open source podcasters, also people who are producing stuff on the commons, like Edit Zero and the Open Metal Cast and the Love, you know, the Love Bug. Bugcast, right. I mean.
Yeah.
But, yeah, they were oversubscribed by 50%, so alas, Pindacus.
So it never came off.
No, we'll try again next year. Try again next year.
Yeah. Well, I'm trying to think of new shows for the coming year.
That's what I like to hear, folks.
I was having to play with Ubuntu without Unity the other day and realized how much Unity and the GNOME 3 are just the same, really. So it's not a massive difference, not, you know, getting rid of Unity and staying with GNOME 3. And it just reiterated why I moved over to Mate.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if you are still using Linux.
I switched to Fedora on a, I think, 3 or 4 years, more probably 5 years ago. Lord D says, yeah, well, I was complaining about RPMs. He says, yeah, well, have you tried it recently? And then I said, actually, it's a good point. I haven't. So then I tried it, and I've been using KDE-ish, mostly the KDE desktop without all the KDE stuff turned on.
Right. Yeah, KDE is quite a mature desktop now, so I think it's getting back to the dizzy heights it used to have before the KDE Forza.
Yeah, that
fiasco
was not pleasant. No.
Yeah.
The 680 ohm resistor, from the looks of it, is going from the pin where you put in the component, and then the trace goes back up to pin 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 of the ATMEG. Okay, I'm going to continue on putting these in. And is it the Ogcamp? Does it? How likely is it that it'll go ahead?
I've heard it's pretty good. You know, pretty good possibility. I think John Spriggs is still involved with it. And if John's got anything to do with it, I'm pretty sure it'll carry on.
John, the nice guy, Spriggs.
Did you say pin 14 on the Hetmel?
Yeah, there's three of them there, and it goes from pin 1, 2, or connection point 1, 2, and 3. It goes to a 470K resistor, and then tees off to a 680 resistor, which spans a gap, comes up through a via, and then connects directly into the Arduino.
14's a clock pin.
Okay, that's a bit odd. Well, let me see. One, yeah, because I flipped. I put in a link to the PCB there on the show notes.
Yeah, I was looking at that. You'd have to trace it from the other side to figure out what's going where.
Yeah, but the other side is there. So the second half is. Hold on, I'll save it in landscape and then upload it again.
Yeah, I can see both of them.
Okay, if you flip it 90 degrees, then you can see the bottom is one for one, so the whole spacing has been mirrored, so you can see, makes it easier to trace. So there are three 680 ohm resistors there, and they go from, let's say the one that connects to connection point one, that goes down and then comes up to what would be pin 1, 2.
So they basically go straight across from wherever they are.
Yeah, well, that one goes down to the very bottom right-hand pin on the same row as pin 1. And then the next one goes straight across. Yeah, all the other ones go straight across. Fascinating stuff. It's a bit like a Lego puzzle actually.
And yes, I am putting them all in the same way.
Yeah, make sure you put those resistors the correct direction.
Don't listen to them, guys. There are lots of people who wouldn't know that.
Yeah, resistors don't matter. Some caps do, some caps don't. Look for the plus or minus if you see that. It needs to go a direction.
This is awesome. I am having an immense amount of fun. Okay, I'm got to go for breakfast. Tune in after breakfast for more exciting resistors. We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 more of these to go through. Ye obviously don't have to be involved in that process. Okay, back in a bit.
Okay. Who else is on here at the moment?
I'm on JRulo 2, that's me.
Hi, JRulo.
Hello.
So apart from the scintillating talk through of Ken doing his soldering, is there any other conversations going on at the moment?
Not for a while. They were talking about a bunch of interesting stuff earlier.
Okay. What's your interests?
I'm all over the place. I do web development and manage a couple of servers, and then I've been doing some 3D printing lately. Also do some Arduino stuff and Amiga stuff and, of course, Raspberry Pi, this or that.
Pretty old, good HPR material.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
Ken wants me to do an oscilloscope tutorial of some kind.
Yeah, that would sound like a good show, actually. I'm a member of my local makerspace here in Blackpool in the UK, and we've got a 3D printer and a laser cutter and various other bits of kit that were...
Neat.
Well, we're in the process, or one of our members is in the process of building a CNC router. And we 3D printed all the plastic parts for that.
Is that the MPCNC?
I couldn't tell you exactly what model it is. A lot of the components came through either eBay or AliExpress. But he's currently in the process of building the electronic side of it up at the moment. The actual layout of the router is pretty well built. Getting the control electronics all sorted at the moment.
I'm on a show with the Podnuts people called The Makers with a Z.
And
every other Friday or so we get together and do a show, but there's a lot of, I think three of the guys on that show are building this router called the MPCNC, and it's MP as in mostly printed CNC, so all the connectors are 3D printed. So the corners and the pieces and the thing that holds the X and the Y and the Z,
yeah,
that's all 3D printed, and then you get your own router head and, you know, Arduino electronics and stepper motors and all the little pieces and the wires and stuff and put it together. But this one guy, Chad, has redesigned it in Fusion 360 to be a double rail. So normally you have the, if you're using that electrical conduit metal pipe as your rails. He's put it together so that it doubles that. So for the X and the Y, it's the same thing except doubled. And so he's remade the 3D printed parts to have that double rail. And of course you need the, you know, double the bearings and everything else to roll on it. But it's super, super solid, according to his reports. And it works so much better than the original.
I was going to say, it'd give it a bit more rigidity, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it's super rigid. And so he's been making clocks and stuff with that and selling them.
Clocks? Wow.
Yeah, he takes like a disc, a, you know, plywood wooden disc, and carves, you know, some pattern in it. So he'll do like a Death Star scene or a logo of some... you know, like Coors, some beer company, or somebody's, you know, business logo or whatever, and then put a clock in the middle of it. And then you put that on your wall and that's a clock, and he'll stain it. So it's like a two-tone relief of whatever your logo is on the background. Wow. And then, you know, the numbers and stuff.
That's cool.
Yeah. So he's working on, it's not done yet, but he's working on putting it together so that he can release it as a project. So as kind of a, you know, click here to upgrade all your stuff. But he's finalizing a couple of pieces. But he's been using it successfully, and it's working for him, so it looks like a good deal.
Oh. Yeah, we're currently in the process of thinking up ideas for the laser cutter at the makerspace so that we can monetize that a bit to generate a bit of cash to buy other equipment and stuff, and build up a supply of components and that, so that when we get new people come in who've got projects, that we've got a bin full of stuff that they can just go along and pick stuff out of.
So how do you pay for the space now?
At the moment, we've got a core of about between 5 and 10 of us, and we pay a couple of quid a session. Then that covers the insurance and stuff like that. At the moment, we haven't been using an awful lot of material and stuff, so we're not having to worry about paying for stuff like that. But we're thinking about when people come to use the 3D printer and the laser cutter and things like that, they'll have to pay for materials and stuff to cover those costs. Probably a little bit extra to cover the cost of electricity and stuff like that. But yeah, we're a very small group. We meet in the basement of a local hotel. One of our members is the proprietor of the hotel, and he gave us the basement, basically.
The hardest thing is finding a space that isn't expensive.
Yeah, so that was fortunate, but we're a little bit cramped, we could say. But we started off as a Linux user group in the business of one of our members who was the local computer recycler company, small social enterprise. And we used to meet in his venue, but he retired a couple of years ago and the venue was sold off, so we had to find a new home. But over the years, we've morphed from just concentrating on the software side, using open source software, Linux, etc., to doing more hardware stuff. Started off with a couple of the members learning to program in Python, and then starting to integrate that into showing the kids how to use Python. And then the Raspberry Pi came along, so looking at robots and stuff like that that kids are interested in. So we've kind of morphed over the last few years.
So you have like a kids program over here. They have a thing called STEM, which is, I don't know what the acronym is, but it's basically to get kids interested in electronics.
Science, technology, engineering, and maths.
There you go.
I'm actually a STEM ambassador here in the UK. We run a local Raspberry Jam and Code Dojo.
Okay, yeah, one of the guys in my... We have a computer meetup, computer programmers meetup, that we do every couple of Wednesdays, and one of the guys runs the dojo at one of the schools.
Yeah. One of our members, you may have heard of him because he writes for various magazines, including Linux Format, Les Pounder, or Big Les P.
Yeah.
When the Raspberry Pi first came out, he started getting really big into that. That's back in 2012, and we'd go all over the Northwest doing Raspberry Pi events and stuff. So we got quite heavily involved in that because it kind of fitted in with the Linux user group, because the Pi ran on Debian, or a heavily modified version of Debian. Then that was how we got involved with using the Pi in various things. And kind of things have just cascaded from there.
What kind of laser have you got now?
It's a Chinese rip-off. It cost us about 300 quid, and it's taken a couple of years to get fully up and running, because as a lot of these things that come over from China, they're great, but when you start delving into them, some of the electronics and the safety features aren't quite as up to, shall we say, European or American standards.
The 40-watt blue box one?
Yeah. Yeah, so
we're on our second one of those.
Oh yeah, they're a nice little machine once you get them set up and you know configured.
Yeah, it works great. I made all kinds of cool stuff with that thing.
Yeah. You've just got to know what you're talking about as far as safety goes and make sure that you can upgrade the safety features or the non-existent safety features, shall I say. Yeah, we've put a lib cutout switch in it and various other things. I think we've upgraded the actual control electronics as well. So, but that's up and running. Started doing a few cuts with that just before Christmas. Made some Christmas baubles. So
have you been able to get off of the Chinese software?
Yeah, I think we're using. I'm not 100% sure what the software is, but it's an open source.
There's a LaserWeb 4, I think, is out. It's supposed to be pretty good.
Right. But Les is the one who's been setting that up. Like I say, we made a few baubles with it just before Christmas. But like I say, plans are to start thinking about what we can make that's going to be a bit more useful than that.
Yeah, as long as you got good ventilation, you can do all kinds of really neat stuff with thin acrylic.
Yeah, that was one of the things we've got ventilation set up, so it actually vents to the outside. But one of the things we were finding, depending where the laser head was, the internal that little fan that sucks it into the ventilation wasn't strong enough to get rid of all the smoke. So we've actually put a fan at the front end of the machine to push the smoke into the vent, so that the extractor fan can get hold of it a lot easier and get it into the vent tube.
One of the things that I've done is, if you'll notice, everywhere there's a seam, you should put some kind of tape or like a single-sided sticky foam into those little gaps, and that will greatly improve the ventilation sucking. So if you leave, like, over the control board on the side, there's a couple of holes on that wall, and then there's a hole into the main laser box, then there's the exhaust. If you leave that passage open and seal everything else, you get a good air passage through there. The other thing I did is I spent like $13 on Amazon and got it's used for like your washing machine dryer vent. It's a secondary fan for that, so it's exactly the same size. And so you put that in line with the other one, so you get the crappy Chinese fan that is on the thing already, but then you get this like 12 volt, it's actually 120 volt, but it's, I think the fan is actually 12 volt, inline secondary fan that you can put kind of towards the exit, and it'll suck, you know, three times harder to get all that stuff out. And as long as you've got everything else in the box sealed, you know, the laser compartment, underneath there's some holes, around the lid, you know, all those little spaces you see, you know, one, you can keep the bad, you know, vaporized stuff from getting into the space you breathe.
Yeah, that's been one of our problems.
The airflow is just so much better.
Right. Oh, I'll have a look at that next time I'm there. Mention it to Les as well and see whether we can do something about taping up those gaps.
Even just blue painter's tape will work. Just something sticky that doesn't come off.
Yeah, the kind of stuff you put on the bed of a 3D printer, that kind of stuff, masking tape.
Yeah, you don't need silver tape except for, you know, maybe the fan ducts, but, you know, on the machine itself, whatever tape you got is fine.
All right. That sounds like a good idea. You don't realize how many gaps are in these things, because they're only folded. It's only folded pressed steel, isn't it? And the connections where it all joins together won't be that brilliant. So
no,
makes sense that there's gaps in it.
Well, then every one of those doors has a spring-loaded hinge that you can just take all those doors completely off, and there's a, you know, quarter-inch gap almost all the way around every door.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And you don't ever need to get into the control box area. The only thing you need to get into is where you access the material. You know, you can seal up the laser tube and everything and not have a problem.
Right. That sounds right, yeah. Oh, thanks for that. So whereabouts in the States are you?
Hawaii.
Oh, right.
Do you have a link to that discussion, by the way?
A link to that discussion? Yeah, it's HPR New Year's episode 32.
Wah, 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 wah.
Welcome back, Ken.
What, was it 3D printers or what?
No, we were talking about the laser cutters. Printer.
Got a particular link to one so we know what we're talking about?
It's the K40 Chinese one everybody has.
Except me, apparently. Shall I put the K40 laser cutter how to engrave instructables thing in?
Well, you gotta get the laser cutter first.
No, I don't even know where.
I'm looking for a good link.
I can't even find it. It's telling me all the parts, but not the main box.
I've got a link here on eBay.
Oh, they won $120 for the rotary cutter. That's worth about $10.
That's okay. Paste that link at least into the show notes so we know, or into the mumble chat.
Done.
Whereabouts?
I'm not finding one.
Don't see it.
I've just pasted it in under your Ken suggests a show on Bitscope and Raspberry Pi.
Ah, okay. Yeah. We've moved on.
But I thought it was still between 10 and 11, so.
Actually, that's a good point. Right. Laser cutters, are they fun?
They can be very, very much fun and also very useful. If you look at the number of Raspberry Pi cases made out of laser cut acrylic and various other cases and things. But I was watching a video of an actual 3D printer, and some of the 3D printer sides are actually made from laser cut acrylic. It's not the best material in the world.
Yeah, you want to stay away from those.
It tends to fracture, but...
Well, it's not... It doesn't... You have to readjust them all the time because they vibrate apart.
But the... I'm trying to think of the 3D printer we had at the Makerspace that was... the sides were laser cut acrylic.
Yeah, you definitely have to dial them in. Do you guys have thermal paper? Like you go to the grocery store or whatever and they print you a receipt and it's on thermal paper, not printed paper?
I haven't got any thermal paper now.
I worked on early Zebra printers that did lots of that stuff, yeah.
So you can take... That's the best paper to test your laser with. So you put that in front of the lens hole and... you can line up your mirrors that way.
Ah, what a good idea.
And it's free. Unless you're buying TVs or something.
$33K. No, actually, 3.3. That'll be written 3K3.
Yeah, you'll see voltage written that way too.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org.
We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.